Good afternoon, everyone. We do not yet have a quorum, but I anticipate we're going to have one in a few minutes. Now the tax committee is adjourned. Just in the interest of time, I'm going to get started here with House File 2640, and we'll take testimony on it. As soon as we have a quorum, we'll officially convene the meeting and move the bill. Before we get started, if anyone has got any of these bills that they want to testify, any of the five bills today, I'd ask you to contact Bridget, our page. Bridget is standing right over there. Bridget, raise your hand. Talk to Bridget and let her know that you want to testify. Greg, you're already there. You get to testify. With that, members, let's get started now, even though we don't have a quorum, so we can save some time. Representative Davids, welcome back to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 2640 was before this committee several weeks ago. Then we took a detour. We went to Chairman Smith's committee, Judiciary Finance. And what we did in that committee was we removed Article 2. And, Mr. Chairman, I see in the bill before us, Article 2 is included. After Representative Smith's, Chairman Smith's Judiciary Finance Committee, we had removed Article 2. But now there's some confusion. We've, I think, taken care of that. And we have an amendment, an A6 amendment, put Article 2 back in. What Article 2 does, well, first of all, Article 1 sets up the funding for an insurance fraud prevention unit in the Department of Commerce. Several years ago, the law was passed to put the insurance fraud provisions in place into law, but they were not funded. So what this bill does is it funds it, and it's not funded from the general fund. It's funded from the industry. They've agreed to the assessments that you'll see on page 4. And this would fund the insurance fraud prevention unit. And then to Article 2, which would be the A6 amendment, I'm not sure I want to handle it because it's already in the bill, but it's really not in the bill, I don't think. That's Article 2 is the auto theft prevention unit, which would be moved over from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Commerce. Both entities, both departments have agreed to it, so long as we would entertain and pass the A7 amendment to put some language in, basically for the public safety department to be able to still have some input as to where the grants go and so forth. Okay, I had a second engrossment. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I now have the third engrossment, which should have it out of there.
And so as I understand here, what we will need to do is people may have two different engrossments sitting in front of them. We have House File 2640. The third engrossment is what we want. There is the A6 amendment to the third engrossment, and then there is an amendment to the amendment. Is that correct, Representative Davids?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So it's one.
No, it's not an amendment to the amendment. It's just an amendment.
No, I believe it's an amendment to the amendment. At least that's what it seems to say.
Like I said, Mr. Chairman, it's an amendment to the amendment.
All right. We will take care of putting it in order as soon as we get a quorum here. But Representative Smith, I'm wondering, since it went to your committee, do you have any comments you'd like to make on the bill?
On the may I address the A6?
And you can address the amendments, yes.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. In short, I won't go through the whole history, but the reason that I thought it needed to come to our committee was because the bill was amended earlier in its process, adding Article 2 to the bill, Article 2 containing the Auto Theft Prevention Board, and since the Judiciary Policy Finance Committee reviews that line item as part of its tasks, we took and gave the bill a hearing. If you allowed it to go there, we decided as a committee that it would be best that Article 2 be amended out, to be left with the Department of Public Safety for various reasons. And subsequent to that, it became a little clearer that perhaps the governor's position was that Article 1 and 2 should be left intact and move forward. My concerns were then addressed with the two items in the A7 amendment. Number one, even though the Auto Theft Prevention Board is being transferred, that if the A7 amendment passes, and I trust that that will be a friendly amendment to the A6, that the consultation of the Commissioner of Public Safety would still occur, and with regard to developing the criteria for distributing the funds, and also the statutory language currently requiring the governor and the legislature to be notified of the activities and expenditures be amended to require that the chairs and the ranking minority members of the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction over the Department of Commerce and Public Safety be notified. So with that, that would be the reason for the A7.
Okay. Well, members, we now do have a quorum, so I will officially convene the meeting. Clerk will note the roll. I will note again there is a quorum. We have the minutes of the April 27th meeting in front of us. Are there any additions, corrections, changes to the minutes? Seeing none, Representative Queasley moves approval of the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, with that, the chair will move that House File 2640, the third engrossment, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Rules. Representative Queasley.
Mr. Chair, I was wanting to make the motion to recommend it not to be passed and it would be laid on the table. Get us out of here quicker.
Mr. Chair.
We're talking awfully smart for so early in the meeting. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to talk a little bit about the A6th Amendment and the process of this bill. It seems to me that the Judiciary Committee must have felt, on the legislative side, very firm and on a bipartisan basis, that the auto theft prevention portion be left with the Department of Public Safety. And so that part was removed. Now we come back to Ways and Means, and we're putting it back in again. I understand the all-powerful Ways and Means Committee, and understand also bureaucracies getting together. But at the same time, it seems to me that there must have been some compelling reason on a very bipartisan basis for the Judiciary Committee to have removed that article and kept the auto theft prevention within the purview of the Department of Public Safety. I know when you have a car stolen, you call a cop. You don't call your insurance department. At least, I think, 99% of the people do because they want to report the theft of a police car. They may call the agent the second time, but the first part.
What?
And I just find it kind of difficult to see why we're going backwards now. Maybe Representative Smith can explain what happened in the Judiciary Committee and why we're undoing that committee's action.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'll give you the answer, and that is I requested the bill because at first glance I didn't think it was appropriate. In our committee hearing, we reviewed the Auto Theft Prevention Board, and just for sake of the record and anyone else listening, it's that program was up and running since 1996, and it's funded by charging 50 cents for everybody who pays auto insurance in this state. That policy was set in 1996. The Auto Theft Prevention Board doles out grants to various recipients. Roughly two-thirds of their grants go to county attorneys and the gang strike force. Roughly one-third goes to law enforcement, police. The county attorney's office prosecutes auto thieves, and the law enforcement has sting operations and public information to try to catch them. Two-thirds to county attorneys, one-third to police. The facts are that since 1996, auto theft rates have decreased by 29%. It was my fear, and it was the concern of the Judiciary Committee, that when this committee was presented with 2640, Article 1 setting up the insurance fraud police, Article 2 transferring the theft board into the mix, with Article 1 having a funding stream built into it to fund the auto fraud, insurance fraud police, and the theft board funding stream brought into it, it was our concern that the issue of reducing by 29% auto thefts in the state might get lost in the process. And that's why we amended out Article 2. It became clear after that hearing that it was a desire of the governor to do that. And my concerns weren't just to have a separate auto theft board separated into the Department of Public Safety and a separate insurance fraud police force, if you will, in by the Commerce Department. My concern was to see to it that the citizens got something for their 50 cents, that they kept getting a 29% reduction in auto theft rates. Frankly, I saw the handwriting on the wall that somewhere down the road, Article 2 was going to join up with Article 1. So I believe that the two items in the A7 amendment, which keep the Department of the Public Safety in the mix in deciding how the money is spent on these grants, and seeing to it that the judiciary committees in both the House and the Senate be kept also in the mix by getting the information and the power to oversight, that was about all we were going to get, and hopefully that was adequate to keep that 29% reduction in auto theft in the state. So with seeing Article 2 coming back, as chair and as a state representative solely, I decided to put together A7, work on that this morning, and see to it that it got presented today in that process.
Mr. Okay, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, without any question, A7 helps improve that kind of oversight, but I guess from the answer that I got from Representative Smith, the Article 1 must be coming from the governor's office then. Is that a fair say? And I don't mean that disparagingly. He has a right to have his say in court, but it must be from the administration. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, the insurance fraud police was established, and the police, that's the vernacular, was established prior to the current administration. I believe it was set up prior to our current governor. It was just not funded. Mm-hmm. And Article 1, the way I understand the process, came along by itself in March when it was introduced with its funding stream, and then it married up with Article 2. So it's my understanding we did set up the fraud police structure, did not fund it until this bill, and that it, yes, is the governor's preference that these two entities be together and administered by the Commerce Department.
Representative Solberg.
Just one additional question. And in A7, then is there also a safeguard to make sure that the 50 cents is used for the auto theft portion and not commingled in any way with the other funds that for the insurance fraud?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, in the A7 amendment, two answers here. Number one, there is no specific language guaranteeing that we'll see a two-thirds, one-third mix that seems to be working over the last several years. But it's the intent of A7, and it's my intent that by plugging the keeping the Commissioner of Public Safety in it and keeping the House Judiciary and the Senate Judiciary in it, that they will retain that historical knowledge that that mix works and see to it that it is carried out.
Okay, say for people in the audience, just a note on the agenda. The next bill up after this one will be House File 2334, the lands bill with Representative Howes. The next bill will now be House File 606, and then we'll be doing the other two bills that are on the agenda. With that, I will move the A6 amendment, which we've already had some discussion on, and then I'll move the A7 amendment to the A6 amendment. Discussion to the A7 amendment, or perhaps I should say further discussion to the A7 amendment, to the amendment. Any further discussion to the A7 amendment to the A6 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A7 amendment to the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A7 amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now we have the A6 amendment as amended before us. Discussion to that? See no further discussion. All in favor of the A6 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A6 amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now we have the bill as amended. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, in the fiscal note, I know it would be a little unusual in ways and means to refer to the fiscal note, but I thought I'd try. It refers under assumptions that this was prepared on House File 2640, the first engrossment. Can you tell me, are the figures and all the references in it still accurate now to the bill as it is in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, I find it quite unusual that you'd be asking about a fiscal note and Ways and Means. But since you are, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, when this bill was here 2 weeks ago, I raised concerns about the data practices issue. I don't know who dropped the ball, but I didn't know this bill was coming to this committee until I saw it on the agenda last night at 9 o'clock. We've scurried around some this morning, haven't been able to address the concerns. I'm assuming that the author will be willing to continue to work on these issues, maybe in a more timely fashion than in the past, as we move forward and try and get these issues addressed.
This bill does have another stop before the floor in the Rules Committee, and I'd encourage the two of you to work on that issue. Representative Wagenius.
I would like to go back to a question on the A6 Amendment when it's appropriate.
The A6 Amendment.
Well, as it's now been incorporated into the bill.
All right. Please go ahead.
All right. And I don't know who the question should be directed to, but as we transfer...
Representative Wittgenstein, could you use your microphone, please?
Okay. And perhaps Representative Smith is the one to answer this. As the duties and powers are transferred to the Department of Commerce, do we have any outcome that is expected with regard to auto theft? In other words, I'm not understanding why we're not writing into this, why we're not saying, and we expect them to maintain at least a 29% reduction in auto theft. Because, I mean, that's the whole point of, I would hope, of what's going on. Is there a reason that we aren't writing that into these amendments?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I thought about including in the A7 amendment a proposed policy for us to discuss and vote on that would address that, maybe in exactly the words you just said. But then I thought, why limit it to 29%? Why expect a 1/3, 2/3 ratio like I was talking about, or a mix? If something else is a little better, I think the Commissioner of Public Safety, along with this our House committee that I chair, would be able to keep... The point was to keep monitoring it, keep the DPS in it, and keep the House Judiciary Committee in it, because we have a history that the way the money has been spent has resulted in 29% reduction, and I just did not want to see the DPS nor the House or Senate Judiciary elements taken out. So I thought that was the primary goal.
Representative Wagenius.
There may be a time, Representative Smith, when you're not there to watch what's going on. And our governor has said he wants to be judged by outcomes. So while I like what you did in the A7 amendment, I think it's more than appropriate that we look at outcomes here and say something, and I hope we can do this between now and rules, where we are also posing an outcome and you can say 30% reduction in auto thefts at a minimum, to make sure that future generations know what we're supposed to be doing. Because things like this, if they're not put into statute, after a while they peter out. And I think there would be agreement around this table that we don't want to lose that 29% or 30% reduction in auto thefts. I doubt if there's a member here that would want that to happen. So it seems that if that's the case, we ought to write it in. And I would hope that the chair and Representative Smith would be open to that, either in this committee or as we go forward.
Any other discussion? Representative Spielberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, in your amendment A7, if I can ask just a question on it, is it your opinion and opinion of the committee members that have had jurisdiction over the auto theft that there has been a fair distribution of the grants under the supervision of the Department of Public Safety.
Representative Smith.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I think there's been a distribution that seems to have achieved a decent goal.
Okay. Well, I suppose the definition of fair is always in the eyes of the beholder. It depends on where you said. But the reason I'm asking that question is on line 21 and 22, it looks like now the Commissioner of Commerce, under this new language, must develop new criteria for the distribution of the grants. And I'm wondering why we just don't, instead of reinventing the wheel again, use the same criteria that the Department of Public Safety has developed and used over the past years. Now, I understand criteria can change and should be flexible to change, but it seems to me that if there's been at least some achievement in our goals of reducing auto theft, that we would use that same criteria, at least going forward.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I guess my only comment would be twofold. I agree with you. I also see that since we established the insurance fraud police force, if you will, without funding it a couple of years ago, but now it's being funded, that's an avenue that will result, in my opinion, in good in this state, decreasing and attacking insurance fraud, and so as not to lose what we've accomplished so far with the Auto Theft Prevention Board, keep both commissioners actively involved in developing even yet a better formula for the distribution of the funds to attack both problems better on down the road.
Okay.
Any other discussion to the bill? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2640, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next is House File 2334. The chair will move that House File 2334 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Howes, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I will do this as quickly as possible. There's a lot in this bill. Article 1 separates land sale authority of the Commissioner of Administration from land sale authority of the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Also provides that the Commissioner must evaluate all lands to determine value and would be required to require formal appraisal if the estimated value exceeds $50,000. Also eliminates restrictions on public sale of real property to employee or state or of state or subdivisions, provided that the employee is not involved in the sale process, and it continues to prohibit employees of DNR from purchasing land administered by the DNR. Article 2 encourages the sale by private landowners of low-valued lands needed for conservation or recreational purposes when the estimated value of the land is not large enough to compensate the landowner's inconvenience. Allows the commissioner with the landowner's approval to utilize land's statutorily prescribed valuations methods other than the standard appraisal methods when making an offer to purchase certain lands. It also amends the Outdoor Recreation Act as to aquatic management areas to allow lands acquired prior to enactment that meet the criteria outlined in the law to be classified in the same manner as those that have been acquired since enactment. It also directs the agency to meet its fiduciary responsibilities to the Permanent School Trust Fund by either implementing adequate methods of compensation or exchanging school trust lands out of areas that restrict revenue generation. It also changes the time limit for establishing timber sales, timber values on tax forfeited land to be sold from 30 days to 60 days. This makes it consistent with other issues. Article 3 deals with deletions from state forests. There is 4 acres being deleted from the Foothill State Forest. The George Washington State Forest has less than 1 acre being deleted. Paul Bunyan State Forest, approximately 2 acres being deleted. And then there's a deletion from the Mississippi Recreational River Land Use District in Wright County. This has been approved by the DNR. Division of Water staff will provide a protection buffer while allowing development. There are many land sales in there, and I'll tell you where they are rather than describing them in specific detail. You can question me on that later. Aiken County, Beltrami County, Chisago County, Cook County, Crow Wing County, Hennepin County, Itasca County, Lake of the Woods County, Mille Lacs County, Olmsted County, Rock County, Rosso County, and St. Louis County. And then members, Mr. Chairman and members, before the question will be asked of me, I will also state that the DNR is not planning on acquiring any land as a result of this bill. The DNR is planning on offering 177 acres for sale as a result of this bill. Obviously, there is no dollar gain because there are no dollars lost because of acquisitions because there are none. But the approximate dollar value of the DNR sales is about $150,000, and I'll stand for questions.
All right, there are a number of amendments. Representative Osment, maybe I'll call on you for an amendment, unless someone has a question for Representative Howes right away. Representative Osment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's an amendment being passed out right now. It's an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. It says page 40, line 27, add. I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay, Representative Osment moves the 8.5 by 11 amendment, beginning with subsection page 40 after line 27, add subsection C, notwithstanding Minnesota statutes. Representative Osment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn over the explanation of this to the author of the bill, and can maybe give us a. I didn't get quite all the background in this.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman and members, I will do the best I can, but there are people here that can be more definitive if you need be. I got this late this morning. There is a land transfer that was approved through the subcommittee and through all the other committees up in Cook County dealing with federal and state land. Unfortunately, there would be some small portion of land left over after all the transaction took place, and it was pointed out by the DNR to Cook County that they had no language in this bill to be able to sell what land would be left that borders public water. So we had to put this language in so that would take care of that.
Okay. Representative Osment.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, the DNR has taken a look at this and is also supportive of this language.
Okay. Discussion to the Osment amendment. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to hear a little bit more about, are we selling some pristine lakeshore property up there to the lowest bidder, or what's going on?
Could we have someone from the DNR come forward, maybe?
What? Yeah, to the lowest bidder.
Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record and your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name's Kathy Lewis with the Department of Natural Resources. This is a parcel that Cook County has is exchanging with the United States government, and they propose to proceed with a public sale. And under the statutes, they will need to be doing it at appraised value for the property. It's not a pristine wilderness site.
Everything ought to be dying
out here. Well, Representative Earhart.
I'm trying to figure out if this is another Rukavina sweetheart deal up there. That's what I'm trying to dig at. What lake is this on? Who are you selling it to?
Representative Howes or Ms. Nunes?
Mr. Chair, there is not a designated party for the sale. It would be through public sale, so that is to the high bidder. And I do not have the name of the lake with me, unfortunately.
Is it, Mr.
Representative Earhart?
Madam, is it 50 feet on a waterfront or 3,000?
Mr. Chair, it is exceeds the 150-foot standard that would require DNR approval, and I do not have the footage. The front footage.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, it's about 264 feet by 165 feet. And actually, it's a 48 tract on Saginaw.
Other discussion on the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the Osmond Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The Osmond Amendment is adopted. There are some other amendments. I'm afraid I don't know whose they all are, so I think, Representative Osmond, you've got another one. Is yours the 1407 amendment?
Correct.
Okay, Representative Osmond moves the A04-1407 amendment. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an amendment regarding scientific and natural areas, and it's saying that the future SNN areas, as they're designated, would need the approval of the local county boards. We have been having a concern, especially from counties where there's a high volume of publicly owned properties, that the counties want to have some ability to weigh in on those decisions, and this would provide for that local control to be recognized.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have been working with Representative Osmond on this, and the DNR does approve, and I think it's a good amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wagenius.
Representative Osmond. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Osmond, I'm looking at your language, and it's, I'm not sure if I understood you correctly, you were saying that this was had future effect and not past effect. And if that is your intention, I think it's different from what I read on this paper, which says to me that a county board can go in and undesignate right now. And so if it's a future intent, I truly think you need to rewrite it, because at this rate, it's confusing at best. That would be one notion. And can you tell me, Representative Osmond, did I hear your intent correctly, that it's only to be for future parcels?
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you're correct, and that is the way I believe it is spelled out here, and it says that they the area may be designated. No area may be designated unless the designation is approved. If they've already been designated, I don't know how that this would give them authority to go back and undesignate something. I haven't given them that authority. So that you're correct. We're looking to the future.
Well, Representative Wagenius.
I appreciate you're looking to the future, Representative Osmond. I still think the language is mucky enough that a board could argue that they're going to undesignate a parcel based on this this language. I think that could be made. But having said that, I think there is an unintended consequence in this piece of language, and that is if we are taking away an incentive for people to leave in their wills, which is the best way to get by gift, taking away an incentive to leave a land to the state as a scientific and natural resource, because you would expect that if you left it to the state in your will, that's what it would be. But if you knew then that the county could not designate it, then the incentive is just dries up for people who want to preserve their land in a certain way. So I regret that you're doing it for the future, because I think it just lessens our ability to get lands. And I think that it lessens the ability to get lands in counties where there is not much in the way of scientific and natural resource areas. So if I think what you're trying to get at is areas in some counties where there are lots of them, it seems to me a more finely tailored amendment would serve your purposes without having unintended consequences like I see in this particular amendment.
Representative Howes.
I'm going to pass on.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I can see how, as with most legislation this proposed, we can read lots of what-ifs into it. I don't really see a problem with this language as it's written. If there is somehow spelled out, or if you have some language change that you want to propose to us, I'd be willing to listen to that, but I'm comfortable with the way it's written currently.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Vinius. What they're doing up in my area of the state now are people are putting together a lot of conservation easements, and they work very similar, but they're much more friendly to the public, sometimes than SNAs. And I believe that conservation easements will work very well for people that may want to give their land to the state to be open and free for all the birds and the deer and the bear. I think that's a good way to do it. I don't think this will interfere with that at all.
Representative Guinness.
Well, remember, Representative Osmond, we didn't see this language until a few minutes ago, so I cannot come up with language on the spot to say that this is not retroactive, but I think that's how we would get it into the language, is just a simple, this is not retroactive, it's only prospective, and I think council could write that fairly easily. I can't. And I wish we would do that to make sure it's abundantly clear what your intention is. Otherwise, I think we're giving lots of fun to lawyers. Something like that. I mean, it's not difficult language to write, but I think it's council's writing, not mine. But to Representative Howe's question, sometimes what's good for one area of the state, and I understand in your area, is not what's good for another area in the state, particularly some of our southern counties. And I worry that this language will have unintended consequences in our southern counties, while it might be good for some of our northern counties. And that if we could more finely tailor this language, where there is a certain percentage of SNAs, for example, but there are areas in southern Minnesota where there's not much in the way of SNAs at all, and folks would appreciate not only having them for their SNAs, but for the seeds that they could provide. We're trying to go to native plantings, but then eating up the lands that have the very seeds that we need. And southern seeds would be different than northern seeds. I think we all understand that. So I have a lot of problems with this amendment, not with the intentions, but with the amendment itself. It has unintended consequences.
Well, Representative Osmond, maybe if I can refer to council, we may have a solution to the earlier concern Representative Wagenius had raised. Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and members, one way to deal with the concern raised by Representative Wagenius is to add an uncoded effective date following the section that says effective date colon. This section is effective for designations after the date of enactment.
You know, I don't know that that's really necessary myself, but if that is all right with you, Representative Osmond, would you be willing to incorporate that?
I'll incorporate that.
All right, that's incorporated in the amendment. Representative Howes?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Guinness, I don't believe that the language here prevents or makes it more difficult for SNAs to be created in southern counties. It's simply saying that be a resolution of the board of the county, and if the people of the county and the board want to do that, I don't see that as a problem at all.
Representative Queasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a member that represents two southern counties, this is a good amendment.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I think, Representative House, you were not understanding my concern. It was not that the county board should not have some way in, and I, you know, if they want to have way in, that's fine. The question is, more in my mind, is why would I give my lands to the state anymore? And I think that's the issue here. We're taking away an incentive that has been in statute, and we're saying, nah, this isn't the incentive that it once was, because particularly if you are going to, by will, leave your SNA property to the state, and you don't know whether that particular county board is going to designate, whether they're going to designate, and then say, oh, no, I think we're going to undesignate, because this allows undesignation as well as designating in here for lands into the future. I think we've taken away all incentive to give gifts to the state. I think there are other ways to write it if you don't want to take away the incentive, but this takes away the incentive.
All right. We've had a lot of discussion on this amendment. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the Osment amendment with the incorporation that was put in regarding the effective date, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Silbert.
I have an oral amendment at some point. Mr. Chair, I have a couple.
All right. I know there are a few others. Representative Silbert, do you believe yours is non-controversial?
Transposing of two numbers.
All right. Well, go ahead, Representative Silbert.
34, page 34. Line 20, it says document number 176374. It should read number 176347.
All right.
I think that's Torrance property. It needs to have the right number, I believe.
We'll have to vote
again. Okay. Representative Solberg moves an oral amendment, page 34, line 20. Change the number 176374 to 176347. Any discussion to that amendment? Representative Howes, do you have these numbers memorized like Representative Solbert apparently does?
Mr. Chairman, it's a good oral amendment.
Representative Solbert, so does all Torrance property end with a 4-7, or just curious if you can enlighten us how you knew about this.
I got a fact from Macon County Land Department that it's a good thing, but there's a document that needs to be changed, and they transposed the 4 and the 7 to 7-4, and they need to change it back.
You're far too truthful, Representative Solbert. You should have just told us that you remembered it from when you were in the county courthouse looking over the documents.
Mr. Chairman, I thought it was the math teacher coming out.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative House,
just for the record, it's not a stadium piece of property.
All right. Okay. See no further discussion. All in favor of the Solberg oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The Solberg oral amendment is adopted. All right. Who would like to take up the next amendment?
Chair, I've got a number on
you. Go ahead, Representative Rukavina.
Chair, the 0691 amendment. Pretty good.
Representative Rukavina moves the 0691 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, I believe you had the bill last year that did what this amendment is doing. Basically, there was I think 2 years ago, appeals court ruling, or Supreme Court, one of the two, Supreme Court ruling, that reversed 120 years of Cartway easement rights in the state, and said that if you had a water easement, it met the Cartway rule, which even, Mr. Chair, I believe it was like one of your constituents that stayed in court, and it's never been the intent, and that this would be a saying a Cartway is over time.
You're correct, Representative Rukavina. It was a constituent of mine, or at least a resident of the St. Cloud. I don't recall offhand if he's a constituent of mine or not, and I did have such a bill. We should just maybe incorporate it into your bill. Page 2, page 1, line 2, it should be page 24, line 20. Page 1, line 3 should be section 39. Discussion to the 0691 amendment. Discussion of the 691 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the 0691 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The 0691 amendment is adopted. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, the 1344 amendment.
Representative Rukavina moves the 1344 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this was a piece of property that went tax forfeit because of a contract for deed that no one notified the guy that it wasn't being paid. The St. Louis County supports it. Representative Abrams, if he was here, we're going to put it in his one tax bill that public that whatever policy bill. And he said he didn't have to go in there and told me this would be the best place for it. And I talked to Representative Howes. It would go back to the person who lost it, that they would have to pay the penalties, whatever the county decides for it. But the county just agreed that it was in the best interest that the land go back to this person.
Representative Howes, do you have any comment on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm not opposed to the amendment, and if I'm not mistaken, the DNR has viewed this and they're okay with it.
All right. Any discussion to 1344 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the 1344 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rukavina.
And then the last one I have is 1277.
Representative Rukavina moves the 1277 amendment.
Mr. Chair, this is an amendment that tries to deal with the little incident that's happening up in Ely, Minnesota. Representative Dill's district, he asked me if I put it on it here. I've also been involved with it in talking to local folks up in Ely. And the what it happens here is you have a school trust, school section, 1 square mile section, in the Ely city limits where the Hidden Valley ski area is located. As a matter of fact, I used to ski jump there when I was about 45 years ago, Mr. Chair.
You're a ski jumper, Representative
yes,
Rukavina?
Mr. Chair,
they are all nuts.
Yeah. Exactly.
Can we, take you down to Bloomington and have you demonstrate that other one?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've skied on hills that high, but I've got some bad knees now, and I probably wouldn't attempt it anymore. But yes, I know you do. But I'll go off it right after you do.
We'll set you down together holding hands. Go ahead, Representative Rukavina.
I would do that. But in any event, what's happened here is this. The DNR has identified that there is about 5 million yards of gravel. It's a very hilly area, and of course, as you all know, I agree that the DNR has to raise money for public lands. Representative Segrin, off of school trust land. Unfortunately, we think the money should be put in there as quickly as possible. Now there is a move afoot in Ely to convince the DNR to do this over a couple of centuries, which if you took the $5 million investment up front and mined it over 5 or 10 years or whatever, 200 years would lose a lot of interest. This amendment is an attempt to trade a equal amount of land, an equal amount of gravel and land as quickly as we could. It could be mined by then the DNR, put in the school trust, generate revenues off of the interest, and Ely would then be able to deal with the county, because the county would trade that land, and they could continue to have their ski area. It's their Nordic ski team, and that trains there, as do a lot of tourists that ski there. And then the mining could take place over a couple centuries if they so choose. So.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not knowledgeable enough on this specific issue. I would be pleased if the DNR could just weigh on it in on it a little bit, and then it's the committee's decision.
Okay. Ms. Nunes, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Kathy Lewis with the DNR. For Hidden Valley, this is a property. It's Section 36, Original School Trust Fund property. It's currently being utilized for many purposes that generate revenue to the school trust. In addition to the power lines that run through there, there's two. The City of Ely operates a ski jumping site on the property that's under lease from the DNR. There's a private ski club that uses about 250 acres. There's cross-country ski trails on the 640 acres, and there's active aggregate mining that's being conducted on a portion of the area. We have looked at a preliminary aggregate evaluation. It has potential for aggregate revenue of $2.5 to $5 million over a period of years. To do a detailed review of the gravel resource will require further drilling and sampling, and we estimate that would cost about $50,000 to do an adequate appraisal. If you are looking to exchange of the property, we would say the full 640 acres. This is a high-value property site. It would require a similar high-value land exchange from the party in the land exchange, and it also will require some further work. I will note in your legislation you refer to parcels of land owned by St. Louis County. That would have to be fee county land. If you're talking about tax forfeited land, you want to talk about parcels of land managed by St. Louis County. As you know, tax forfeited land is owned by the state and trust for the taxing districts.
Representative Rukavina, from my own perspective, what city is this closest to?
It's in the Ely City Limits.
In the Ely City Limits. I'm sorry you said that. Okay.
In original Section 1636, school sections, it's Section 36 in the Ely City Limits. And members, for your history of consideration on line 10, I say that it's equal or greater value, Representative Segrin, because you know how I feel about this land generating revenues. Ms. Lewis, I would be curious to see what kind of, could you tell us what kind of revenue you're generating now from this annually now?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, we currently have aggregate leases that are generating revenue, and I'm seeing if I have them in my notes here, because we have gathered some information. The lease was, we first issued leases in 1960, so it dates back quite a ways. The current leases, rentals, and we have City of Ely, gravel lease revenue for 1990 to 2004 was $50,000 for that period. We have a recent lease in the last year that raised $3,000. The City of Ely Cross Country Ski Trails is currently paying $9 per 40 per year. We have
$63. You didn't want to tell us $63. $63. Yeah.
That's for the cross country ski trail.
Representative Rukavina, did you introduce this as a bill by any chance?
Mr. Chair, this happened after the session ended, and Representative Hill didn't introduce it as a bill because he found out about the issue, I believe, after the deadline. So he had drafted this as amendment. I think this bill was already put together. And, you know, the county doesn't have a problem with it. I don't know what the state. I've asked Deputy Commissioner Holstead and Bill Bryce hasn't returned my phone calls, and I've made several phone calls to Bill Bryce on this issue. I want, you know, Ms. Lewis, of the 50,000 gravel lease, let me just ask you this quickly. How much went into the forest expense account and then found its way to administrative costs in the DNR, and how much actually went into the school costs?
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, revenue from all state gravel leases on school trust fund land goes to the forest expense account, and then the costs from all those types of revenue from the school trust fund lands is used in the calculation for the management costs. So it's not focused just on a particular lease.
Representative, would it be fair to say that perhaps 40% of 50,000 went in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, there's a portion of the school trust fund gross revenue that's taken for the net, and so it's you know, you've seen the figures. It's the percentages, at least the it's over a third that's for management cost.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, you know, you talk about drilling and everything else, and we've listened to my discussion with, I believe, Mr. Bryce, former Representative Holston in this committee. I think everybody knows there's about closer to 5 million yards of gravel there. It's not a big deal. Representative Segrin, I know you gave him money somewhere to let them milk the system a little more, trying to find them. Drill for gravel, which I don't think in this case they need to do. We could exchange it, and the DNR could make, or excuse me, the school trust fund could make a lot more money quickly, more quickly, over a shorter period of time. Invest that $5 million or whatever, however much it brings in, into the corpus, which would generate tens, if not $100 million over the 100 to 200 years that the Healy community is trying to talk the DNR into managing this so they don't ruin their ski trails. So,
okay,
Chair, it's a very simple amendment. I've asked Mr. Bryce and Commissioner Olson, I called last week about this, to get back to me. Nobody has. I think my amendment, Representative Segrin, puts money more quickly into the school trust by doing it the way I am. And I would incorporate Ms. Lewis' suggestions on line 10 to put parcel of land managed by St. Louis County.
Well, Representative Rukavina, I guess, you know, this is the first we've heard of it. There wasn't a bill on it. We have the bill going to the floor. I sense some hesitation on it from the DNR still. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to withdraw it. Now that you've raised your concern here, you can talk to Commissioner Holston. You can talk to Mr. Bryce. You can get together with Representative Howes and talk about it, and maybe you can work out something for the floor.
Mr. Chair, I've tried to talk to Commissioner Holston and Mr. Bryce. I've talked to Commissioner Holston, and I called Mr. Bryce and left several memos there, or voicemails and messages with his secretary. I haven't gotten a response.
Well, I bet you that you'll get a response now, Representative Rukavina.
I think I will, unless we put it on here. They didn't respond to my Gates on Forest Roads until you helped me put it on in committee. And so,
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have the committee reject this at this point. This is a type of issue that needs to be before the Finance Committee. It's obviously a cost that's involved here with regard to the evaluation of the lands, both the current one that he wants to exchange, plus the verification of properties within the county that would be acceptable. We're talking about an exchange of over $5 million worth of property here. That's a significant exchange. And to have this come up as an amendment in Ways and Means without having the Finance Committees be able to give it some scrutiny, I think, is inappropriate. Although Representative Rukavina raises several very valid issues that I do think we need to pay greater attention to, and that is what is happening with the school trust fund dollars, and how much is really being spent for management versus what the dollars really are supposed to be going towards. So I believe we have some evaluation looking into that issue, and we'll be bringing that forward next year. And that's really where I think this whole issue, I have checked to see if there's an urgency on this particular situation. I know of no urgency. That means that we have to move on it immediately, that we actually can give this the scrutiny that it needs through the committee process.
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
Chair, and that's fine, Representative Osmond. I'll withdraw it for now, but I do have to say this. You know, we're the ones that make decisions here and not DNR bureaucrats, which seems to be happening of late on more of a scale than has happened previously. As far as this issue, Representative Osmond, it just didn't come to light this year. I've been talking about this issue for 15 years. Since 1990, I've been bringing up the fact that there were 10, 11 years where they put zero money into the school children's trust fund as they milked it and milked it and milked it for administrative costs and other costs. Now, there's been studies since 1979, or six, Representative Osmond, that I brought up on the floor. Last 5 years ago, we passed a resolution to Congress to exchange our land with the boundary waters. Now we're going to have another resolution tomorrow, I believe, on the floor, saying the exact same thing that we got ignored 5 years ago. It's time to either do something or get off the pot around here, because, you know, it's been abused. And frankly, why the DNR is managing our school bus land and they have a conflict of interest? It should be going to a finance committee. It should be Representative Segrin's finance committee that not only manages the school bus land, but decides what to do with the money that's being disappearing from our kids for well over three decades now. So I'll withdraw. Perhaps I can get an answer from somebody about this. But I'll tell you, Representative Osmond, what I'm afraid of is vindictive bureaucrats who may all of a sudden decide to show me and Representative Hill just how fast they can raise $5 million up a square section of land without doing all this drilling and turn a really nice ski area into a flat tabletop, because it's gotten to that point, and that's what I'm saying. I'll withdraw the amendment.
Representative Rukavina withdraws the 1277 amendment. Are there any other amendments? Discussion of the bill. Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative House on Section 6, Section 6 on page 30. You have additions to state forests and additions to some wildlife management areas. Can you tell us how much land is being added to these areas? I'm sorry, it's Section 6, 7. 6 and 7 on page 30.
Representative Howes or Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chairman, we're working on it real quick.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lewis.
There's a 7 to 9 40s of land that are being added, so multiply that times 40 acres. And what these are is we were working with the county on identifying clarifying our records on consolidated conservation area lands and tax forfeited lands, and we had misidentified these as tax forfeited lands in our land records, and they are actually consolidated conservation area lands. We had confirmed that with the county, and so this is to complete the formal designation of the lands.
I'm sorry, Ms. Lewis, how many 40s did you say it was?
There's either 7 or 9 40s.
7 or 9,
yeah.
Okay. Representative Krenke.
So this, by these additions, is this, are these just boundary changes, or is there actually going to be a change in ownership of land? What is the intent?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, there's no change in ownership. The land records were incorrect, but the ownership was correct. What it does is add these lands to the state forest. State forests don't always have specific boundaries. Sometimes you do by a parcel-by-parcel basis, and this is on a parcel-by-parcel basis, adding it to the wildlife management areas. So it's not doing a larger extension. It's just a parcel-by-parcel addition.
Representative Krenke?
Again, some clarification. As I said, clarification. There is no additional land acquisition here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krenke, there is no additional acquisition of land in this bill.
Representative Chairman, Krenke. I wasn't asking Representative House. I was asking the DNR.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair.
Does the state own this land now?
The state has owned this land for 30, 40 years. It's not new land.
Thank you, Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I think in counting up, I think there may be 13 40 minutes. That might be a mistake. I may be counting wrong through the land areas.
We got 9 fingers in front up there. All right.
All right.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of House File 2334, as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative House. Next up is House File 606, Representative Smith.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. All right.
606. Representative Smith moves that House File 606 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And I understand that there is the DE3 Delete Everything Amendment. Representative Smith, that's your amendment, I think, correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is.
Okay, Representative Smith moves the DE3 Amendment. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be brief. I have Mr. Holton here to go into any specifics. But 606 was introduced last year by myself and, in fact, was passed out of this committee during session in the year 2003. And the bill got stalled in the Senate dealing with an issue that came up at the end. Specifically, I think an objection by Doar. As I said, the Senate had the bill and it narrowly failed, and it was right at the end of session. And the time was spent between the end of session last year through the summer and until now for the stakeholders, if you will, to come together to iron out their differences. I think the problem that Doar had was Section 11 of the bill. The Senate brought the bill back and reworked it this year, and the DE3 amendment is the verbatim language resulting by agreement of the parties and the action of the Senate. And I think that brings you to date. Again, the ways that your committee, Chairman, passed the bill out the way you see it, except for Section 11 and the reworking by the Senate. So the bill is now back, and I'm asking the committee repass the bill to the House floor, see if we can try again this year to get it passed.
Representative Smith or Mr. Holton, can you tell us some about the bill and exactly what it does?
Representative Knobloch, members, as Representative Smith said, this is the bill that went through many committees last year, including this one. It started with a long run of bitter disputes between health plan companies and health service providers of all types. It has to do with the contracts that regulate the relationship between each other. And there was probably a list of maybe 20-some items that there was a great deal of disagreement about. And that got boiled down to a smaller list. There were numerous meetings between these groups, and they did three things. The healthcare providers dropped a number of issues. The health plan companies and the healthcare providers agreed to take care of other issues outside of the legislative arena. And then, lastly, they agreed to the contractual issues that are in this bill. Some examples of that are in Section 1 has to do with prior authorization requests. And what it does is it provides that there will be a system for electronically putting in the request for prior authorization on a 24/7 basis rather than having people wait along on the phone for 45 minutes or 2 hours. This doesn't mean that the decision has to be made in that time frame. It means that you can get your request into the system at any time, 24 hours a day. One of the major parts of the bill requires that in the contracting process, a provider be provided with all of the contractual information and all of the collateral information that's not necessarily part of the contract, but it's used to determine the rights and the reimbursement rates, for instance, that are in the contract, so that you know what you're getting into when you sign the contract. There's provisions in here about prompt payment. There's provisions in here about unilateral clauses. There's provisions in here which should bring an end to about a 5-year process where the legislature has gotten rid of what they call shadow contracting. That, and what that is or was, is when you sign one contract and then at a unilateral option you end up performing different services under a different basis. And this would provide the provider with the opportunity to make an independent decision if they didn't want the new amended version of their contract. They could opt out of it rather than being forced into it. It had a provision in there about profiling, and that was the provision that that Dewar thought had a fiscal impact on them. They thought that last year that was a bone of contention. It passed through the committees anyway. This year, we decided to finally resolve that issue by removing Section 11. And then also this year, the hospitals, after carefully studying the bill, were concerned that there was language in the bill that would set them backwards on the stacking issue. And so in the amendment here, the hospital's status regarding stacking is preserved at the status quo level. The bill at one time was a lot larger than it is today, and the reason it has shrunk has a lot to do with negotiations and compromises. The stakeholders have signed off on this bill. The health plans, the providers, and if there's any more specific questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Discussion to the bill. Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, does this have a fiscal note now?
Representative Segrin, it's my understanding that it no longer has a fiscal cost. With the addition of the DE3 amendment, it will no longer have a cost.
Okay, so that's all right. So
there is I think there's actually two fiscal notes in the packet, one for the DE3 amendment, which is the Senate language, and one for the original bill. Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Segrin, that is if not the main reason that this bill was before the committee last year. There was a fiscal note. Article 11 caused that. Article 11 has been amended out, and the new fiscal note, therefore, is now zero.
Other discussion? All right. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand there's not a fiscal note because Dewar is not impacted, but I wonder, and I don't know if you're able to answer this or if we need to hear from the health plans. I'm pretty sensitive to health care costs to consumers. Is there expected to be any cost that would have to be passed on to perhaps the private market consumers?
Mr. Holton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, during the protracted negotiations with the health plans, cost was discussed at length. There were a number of items that where there was a demonstrated cost that were modified or removed from the bill. There remained the concept that administrative changes generally, while you can't put your finger on them, generate some cost. The health plans have told us, and I've seen evidence of it, that they have already integrated much of what's in front of you today. So if there were costs related to that, those have probably already been undertaken, and there probably is going to be some more, but I don't think it's identifiable.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a critical issue, and I don't think it's an issue, but it would be nice to sort of have on the record maybe just a moment of testimony from the health plans.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Catherine Kmit. I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. As Mr. Holton was saying, we have spent a great deal of time, several years in fact, working on this legislation together with the provider groups, and we have arrived at this compromise. And while we have testified in the past that there would be some costs associated with the implementation of some of the changes in this legislation, there are changes that are going on all the time, and we have also been moving in this direction to make changes. I can't say that there won't be any costs associated with the bill. I think that that the provider community has been very sensitive to looking at removing those sections of the bill that would have been more costly. But so at this time, yes, there are going to be some changes to change computer systems or make adjustments in how we notify providers and that sort of thing, system changes that will result in some cost. But as far as how much or and that sort of thing, it is difficult to assess.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me paraphrase and see if this is a fair paraphrasing, that that there are costs, but those costs are not significant enough to have a noticeable effect on premiums that might be passed on to consumers.
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Bradley, at this point we think that's probably the case. Again, I can't say with certainty, but there is going to be some cost. We've already started to do some of the things that are going to be required in the legislation. So I think if there was going to be any sizable cost, it's already being built into the overall cost of the premiums.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, the references to the compromise, and I remember how controversial this was before. It's been, I think, relatively quiet this time. I think I've only had one letter, but the references to the compromises and the provider support for the compromise, does that include all provider groups now? Are their representatives, do they all support the compromise?
Mr. Holton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, all of the provider groups that I can think of have either been a part of this coalition or plugged into it with reference to this bill and have indicated their support. Now, there may be some that are not organized that you don't see at the Capitol, but and there's many of them present in this room, but I'd give you a qualified yes on that question.
Maybe phrasing it, Mr. Chairman, a different way. There's no active opposition any longer then as a result of the compromise. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Holton.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're talking about provider groups.
Representative
Chairman,
Carlson.
Mr. Holton, yes.
Mr. Holton.
Yes.
Okay. I understand there's one other individual that wants, or at least one other person that wants to testify on this. Ms. Jones, if you could come forward. And then while she's coming forward, there's a technical amendment that needs to be made to the DE3 amendment, page 11, line 29. Instead of section 12, it should be section 11. And on line 31, instead of section 13, it should be section 12. And Representative Smith, if you'll just incorporate that in your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, yes, thank you.
Okay, Representative Smith incorporates those changes in the DE3 amendment. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Jones, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Carolyn Jones with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We do still have some concerns about the potential costs to this bill. And as has been alluded, while these costs are relatively minor, we do want to make sure that the committee is aware that these are costs. They don't show up in the fiscal note because I think both Dewar and some of the health plans have said that they are a little more intangible things that can't really go into the fiscal note. But there are three reasons, I think, primarily that we still have concerns. I think if you take alone any new mandates or any new regulations, few of them actually have significant costs to the system. But when you keep adding new regulations, new mandates on top of each other, those costs tend to add up. We also are concerned, and to make you aware of the way this is structured, this is different than most mandates or new regulations that the legislature considers in that it will affect all of the provider contract negotiations. And in doing so, it will also affect those self-insured contract negotiations. But because this is legislated, the cost of those changes can only be applied to the small group, to the insured market. So the costs are spread over all of the self-insured companies, yet they really can only be applied to the state insured market. And then finally, that these costs truly are administrative, that we're not getting any new benefits in this package. We're not improving the quality of health care. It's truly going to the administrative bottom line. And so we would just like to raise those concerns.
Other discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Is there anything to do with pensions in this bill?
Pensions in this bill? Not that I'm aware of, Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Other discussion to House to the DE3 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the DE3 delete all amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, we now have the bill as amended before us. Any discussion to the bill? See no discussion. All in favor of House File 606 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Members, I think at this time, Representative Smith, why don't you stay up there and we'll... Oh, you're going to get your other materials.
Which bill, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair? I tell you, Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just wanted to mention that because Representative Rukavina mentioned Mr. Bryce from DNR and hadn't returned calls, and I just want people to know that I've since learned that Mr. Bryce has an illness in the family, and that may be one of the reasons that communications has been difficult. And so it wasn't that he was trying to ignore you. I don't believe he's been available. So just wanted to have that on the record. But.
All right. I think I see Representative Johnson in the audience, and since Representative Smith has to stay all the way through the committee anyway, why don't we bring up House File 2915 at this time? It'll probably also take less time than the final bill.
Yes.
Chair will move that House File 2915 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Johnson, can you tell us about House File 2915?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly hope this takes less time than the pension bill, but we'll find out. This is the recommendation of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council for changes in the workers' comp law. The Advisory Council, as most of you know, was created in 1992 as a permanent council on workers' compensation. Has 12 voting members. Half of them are representatives of business. Half are representatives of labor. It has four legislative members, two from each body, as well as the chamber president and the president of the AFL-CIO. The council advises the commissioner of labor and industry about workers' compensation matters and then also makes recommendations every year for changes to the workers' comp system, and these are those recommendations for 2004. Just so you know, these recommendations only go forward if a majority of the labor representatives and the business representatives approve them, and that is what has happened with this bill. This is a different bill, unlike any that I've carried before, because I didn't draft it. It comes out of the council, and it's a pretty delicate political balance, wherein if one piece gets pulled out, the whole bill essentially falls apart. So I am hopeful that we are able to move forward with this without making significant changes. Having said that, though, I would like to propose an amendment myself, Mr. Chair, to eliminate one of the sections.
All right. Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
That would be Section 21, starting on page 26, line 19. So it would be to delete, starting on page 26, line 19, everything after that. Through the end of page 28.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves an oral amendment, delete section 21 of the bill on page 26 through 28. Discussion to the Johnson oral amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Can I just say this has been approved by the council to remove this section?
All right. Discussion to the Johnson oral amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the Johnson oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have Ms. Anderson from the Department of Labor and Industry with, if you would like her to walk through the bill, that's your choice.
Well, Ms. Anderson, welcome to the committee. Why don't you give us a summary of the bill without perhaps walking through in great, great detail.
Okay. J.B. Anderson, Department of Labor and Industry. I believe the reason this bill is before your committee is because there are provisions in the bill that are medical cost containment provisions within workers' compensation. Those sections start around sections 11 and 12. There are some managed care provisions, some language regarding the fee schedule in workers' comp. Those are primarily where the cost savings are anticipated. There is one other section that is that gets rid of a duplication of reporting that saves about $20,000. But in the fiscal note, you'll see that Doer has anticipated savings as the state is an employer in this bill.
Okay. Chairman, Representative Carlson.
I might ask what's happening with the fee schedule.
Ms. Anderson or Mr. Johnson, Representative Johnson?
I was thinking Ms. Anderson, but if Mr. Johnson wants to answer, that'll be fine.
Section 14 has to do with the fee schedule. There is on page 18, line 5. There's an addition of two words in there called, let's say, service-based classifications. Right now, the fee schedule is provider-based. There's some negotiation going on with different providers as to changing the fee schedule so it's a service-based fee schedule rather than a provider-based fee schedule, meaning that providers would get paid the same regardless of the service.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Anderson, why is the council, what's the goal in proposing these changes to manage care for pharmacies and other providers as opposed to what it is right now? What is their ultimate goal?
The managed Ms. care. Anderson. Thank you, Representative Knobloch. The managed care provisions are in there as a cost containment.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson, is there also a provision in this bill then that cost containment be passed on to the person who is paying the workers' compensation insurance, or is it an extra benefit for the insurance company? Is there a mandate that those cost containments be shipped back to the employer?
Ms. Anderson.
Representative Knobloch. No, there is no mandate written in this bill. However, that is the intent, that eventually the savings would be passed on to the employer.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg,
that may be the intent, but I've seen charts that that doesn't happen, and so the employer still is being what I would term unfairly treated, or I could use words like gouged.
Mr. Chair, to
by,
that point,
the insurance company. But if we are indeed have an intent of reducing the cost, then why there surely should be a benefit to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and other people to make sure that cost is passed on to people like Mr. Gunther and other small business people who are paying the insurance costs.
Members, there are a couple of individuals who want to testify, but before we get to them, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Solberg, to your point, in order to stay competitive, insurance companies do a lot of different things to save money, and that's reflected in the rate structure that they offer. Because if they're not competitive, they don't make sales, and thus they aren't in business very long. So you may not see a direct pass-through with savings where they can say, okay, well, this is going right back to the consumer or to the companies directly. It's in their rate structure. It's all factored in there. So, and it has to be competitive, and that's why they do these things.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative,
I don't know the answer to this, but how many insurance companies now sell insurance in Minnesota? One?
Anyone want to answer that?
Mr. Chair, I can...
Representative Haas?
I can tell you right now, for health insurance, there's only about 13.
No, I'm talking about workers' compensation insurance.
Mr. Johnson, in-house expert on insurance and safety.
work comp.
Okay, let's move on to testimony on the bill here. If someone in the audience wants to come up and give some testimony on that, we can certainly do that. The first person I've got on the list is a, excuse me if I mispronounce the name, Paul Luizel. Mr. Luizel, is that how I say it?
Not bad. Paul Luizel.
Mr. Luizel, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Paul Luizel, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association, and specifically Section 12, opposition to Section 12, which permits certified managed care plans to pay at rates that are below the workers' comp fee schedule. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today on behalf of the MMGMA. Our association is over 50 years old and represents over 300 group practice managers from around the state. These practice managers represent clinics that range from solo practitioners to large multi-specialty clinics that employ hundreds of physicians and other healthcare providers. As you study workers' compensation medical costs, one of your first issues to address is to determine if the purchasers are getting good value for their medical dollar. Perhaps the timeliest report to answer this issue is the study published in February of this year by the Workers' Compensation Loss Data Institute. As you may be aware, this report gives Minnesota an A rating among both returning injured workers to health and productivity, as well as avoiding prolonged absences and medical costs. Section 12 threatens our ability to maintain this A rating as providers that we have worked so hard to achieve. Specifically, it contains language that would permit a certified managed care plan to compensate providers for their services at fees below the workers' comp fee schedule. Since employers can contract exclusively for services through these certified managed care plans, these plans do have a universe of patients that are compelled to use their providers. Gaining access to this universe of patients may make it attractive for some providers to participate, even if the reimbursement is discounted. It will also enhance the profitability of managed care plans, giving them additional incentives to sign up employers. So who benefits from Section 12? Do workers benefit? Absolutely not. Not only will the injured worker have no choice except to use a certified managed care roster of providers, but the choice will become even more limited as providers unwilling to discount their fees drop out. This decreases the likelihood that an injured worker will be able to see the provider of their choice. In addition, the providers willing to work for deep discounts may not represent the best community standards of care. Do providers benefit from Section 12? In no respect. Interim hearings by an advisory committee to the Department of Labor and Industry did not yield any recommendations to change or reduce the current fee schedule. Testimony before the committee highlighted the complexity and demands on provider time inherent in the workers' compensation system, which justify the reimbursement paid to providers. I think if you haven't received a handout of a flow chart, have you received that? Rachel's going to hand out a flow chart, and on that flow chart, it displays the difference from an administrative and clinical standpoint of what it takes to care for a workers' comp patient versus a commercial or HMO patient. And on the right-hand side of that chart is the workers' comp patient. And if you don't dig into the detail, just looking at the sheer number of boxes on the right-hand side of that paper demonstrates that we do receive more reimbursement through workers' comp, and it is justified from a work standpoint. In our recent informal survey of two of the largest clinic systems in the state, one small primary care clinic and one orthopedic clinic, we learned the following. The average days it takes to collect payment from an insurance company was about 28 days. The average days in accounts receivable for Medicare was about 37 days. For workers' comp, the average days to collect receivables was 83 days. 83 days compared to 28 days for the non-workers' comp patient. Do employers benefit from Section 12? No. This bill does not require insurance companies, as we learned, to pass along savings to employers in the form of reduced workers' compensation premiums. In fact, many of the providers most effective in treating workers' comp injuries and who have been responsible for improvements in earlier return to work results may be the very providers who drop out of the certified plans if the fee schedule is discounted. This would be very costly to employers in the long run. So who benefits? I think it's plain that insurance companies benefit. Insurance carriers and managed care plans would be the only winners. They would realize enhanced revenues at the expense of injured workers, providers, and even employers. Thank you. I'll address any questions that you may have.
Seeing no questions, could Judy Holly come forward? Ms. Holly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Judy Holly. I'm a physical therapist, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. We're an association that represents over 1,500 physical therapists, PT assistants, and PT students here in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify against Section 12B of this bill. You do have a handout of mine. It has the APTA logo on the top, and then it has a chart on the back that I'll be referring to the chart. Section 12B relates to managed care, and we're asking for that section for you to give serious consideration to delete that section of the bill. Having managed care, there is managed care in Minnesota right now for workers' comp, but it is at the same fee schedule. And the back of my testimony has a chart that shows all of the different non-reimbursed clinical costs related to workers' comp. This chart shows the increased activity, communication, coordination that must occur with an injured worker. All of this is done without reimbursement. That is why the work comp system at this time is, providers are reimbursed at a higher rate because the system recognizes the increased activity related to getting an injured worker back to work as soon as possible, at the highest level possible, and safely. We believe Section 12B, if it were to pass, would compromise patient choice, obviously, as alluded to earlier. There would be a compromised, potential compromise in level of expertise and compromised speed of return to work. And those are all listed in my written testimony there. So we have serious concerns about Section 12B of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion? Representative Earhart.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, why have the workers come forward prior to this? And why
I have testified four or five times in both the Senate and the House side about this.
Representative Earhart. Ms. Holly.
Thank you. It did pass out of different committees. I know it has passed without recommendation.
Other discussion to the bill? Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would, Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO and Tom Hesse from the Chamber are both here. I wasn't going to ask them to testify, but based upon the testimony that neither providers nor employees will benefit, I thought it might be important for them to come since they both sit on the advisory council, and this is the compromise between labor and business. So I believe that they would probably suggest that both employees and employers would benefit, and maybe can explain why.
Chair? Representative Rukavina.
I don't really need to hear from Chamber or a union about this.
Since when?
So that's your that union thug you referred to. I think he was your former employee, wasn't he? Oh, the houses. That's right.
Section in question.
A representative Rukavina makes an oral amendment to delete section 12. Well, I think I'm not sure who would like to speak first, but let's have Mr. Hesse and Mr. Leto come down then. And whoever wishes to speak first can.
And
Representative Johnson.
And Mr. Chair, this would go directly to that section 12B, which I think both testified that it does not benefit employers or employees.
Okay, and Representative Kroenke.
Well, maybe Mr. Leto could expand on the horrible working conditions under Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, that's why I didn't want to come.
Mr. Hesse, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber does support this legislation and do believe that it will have benefits to employers. Just the fact that we can, that insurers and managed care plans can negotiate rates should be able to wring out some costs in the work comp system. Currently, the same injury or the same condition can cost significantly more in workers' compensation than it would for your general medical care, and that difference is what this bill is trying to get at least begin to get at. We look at the 1995 changes in workers' compensation. There was no mandate that any savings be mandated that employers receive, yet employers saw rates drop in about the next four or five consecutive years, so that without a mandate, I think there's still the market will make sure that employers do see the benefit of these changes. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina.
Isn't it true that rates were dropping before 95%? There was a pattern of them dropping, and WICO was already coming to the legislature saying that they wanted to get some rebates to the employers, and which in fact ended up as Representative Sober alluded to, the first rebate didn't find its way to the pockets of the employers other than the self-insured. It just made it to the insurance companies. But isn't that the case that worker comp rates were already on a downward spiral when the 95 bill passed?
Mr. Hesse
and Representative Rukavina, if I recall right, the Minnesota Work Comp Insurers Association's pure premium base rates, I think, dropped in 1995, but I think 94 was its peak, so it would have been 1 year prior. The slope of that curve, however, dropped significantly more after the 95 reforms, so that there certainly was a change in how the savings were, how the pure premium base rates responded after the legislation was passed.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, in 1986, the work comp rates took 100% rate increase. The loss reserves of insurance carriers was way down at that time. That's why they had such an increase. The carriers at that point made a conscious decision that they had to build their loss reserves back up, and which they had accomplished by about 1990. They were in significant shape. That investment income from those loss reserves started buying down rate increases, and due to investment return, which was good during the 90s, and we saw it all the way through the 90s up until about 2 years ago, when we had the 9/11 incident, investment income went down because the companies had to take the loss reserves to pay for the losses of World Trade Towers and things like that. So that's that's kind of a little history on what rates have done, and that's why rates and work comp have gone up, because investment income has been down, and they haven't been able to underwrite the rates to keep the rates in line. So it's a whole system of trying to keep rates down that they work at. And yeah, I was just reading in this flyer here from the therapist that, you know, the cost savings pass through, they don't see it, because all these factors are built in to keep the rates down. And the last thing that helps keep the rates down are the lost reserves and that investment income. So when you say the insurance company profits, they put that money into lost reserves so they can buy down their rates and keep competitive. That's the real key.
Well, perhaps we're going to have Mr. Leto come on down here and have his testimony. Mr. Leto, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please state
Thank
your
you,
name Mr. for the record. Give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members. My name is Brad Leto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and we do support the package in total. And by the way, I have nothing but compliments in my employment with Representative Rickaveen in the House of Representatives. He was a wonderful employer. And,
Mr. Chair, the only thing is we have the 24-hour rule.
Yes.
Every letter I wrote, they hid for 24 hours. They showed it to me the next day and asked me if I really wanted to send it.
Sounds like a good rule, Representative Rufferina.
It was.
Mr. Leto.
Mr. Chair, we do support the Minnesota AFL-CIO and the members of the Advisory Council who represent public employees, building trades, industrial unions, do support the package in total. Are there things we like better than others? Absolutely, but we support the package in total. I will say that I know we've always had discussion about passing through the savings to employers so that rates go down or stop increasing in certain factors. We have always had that discussion, and I can only say that I know that's not in here. It was in the 1992 bill. There was a provision, not in 95, that should rates not see any compression or stop increasing or see some reduction on the medical side, I think for further medical provisions, the members of the Advisory Council would be hard-pressed to agree to further change on that if this does not appear to be working. So I would just add that, but as you know, there are some good things that we like in here as well, and so we do support the package in total, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, Mr. Leto, are you opposing the Rukavina oral amendment then to delete Section 12?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina.
Perhaps you and the Speaker are controlled by the unions, but I'm not. I'm trying to vote what's right for injured workers, and the fact of the matter is that the only people that have been hurt and have been nicked away with are injured workers, and there's a special reason why there are higher costs in this system, is because, remember, an injured worker, because of laws passed by chambers of commerce across this country, the industrialization of the United States made it so that an injured worker couldn't sue their employer. Now, for that, you know, plus there's all kinds of things you have to do to document what's happening, what etc. That's the reason why I'm talking about it. These workers have to jump through hoops, and they cannot even be compensated, and certainly not very fairly anymore. We've had numbers of workers and Mr. Leto, you know this is the case, that have reached maximum medical improvement and are on welfare. Where any other court of law would have given these people huge settlements, they don't get them. At least we should be able to take care of them and give them the medical care they deserve. And I think there are questions and concerns raised here by these folks that provide the services, and therefore I think I have a good amendment, and I'm hoping that at least my side of the aisle, along with a few folks like Smith and others, which will give me a vote, and I'm hoping actually
those of you that never support unions in the past, which are most of you over there, would support me on this too.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I hate to disagree with Representative Rukavina, but I think it's to say that this somehow hurts injured workers is kind of stretching things a bit. I think it's fair to say that the people who came up to testify, that this could mean they receive less in fees. The groups that are most concerned about this are the parties that are paid by the system. And I don't criticize them for not liking the idea of providing a negotiating provision in there that might allow parties to negotiate a lower fee, because it could hit their bottom line. So I think it's fair that they're making the argument, but to argue that this is somehow going to hurt injured workers is I don't think that's accurate at all. And I think it's important to point out that this is possibly the most important cost containment provision in the bill. And if we take this provision out, I can guarantee you the bill is dead, and that may be what some people want. That's fine, but we have to keep in mind last year the Senate essentially rejected the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council process, and we will be doing that this year should we pull this provision out.
All in favor of the Rukavina oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. To the bill. Discussion to the bill? See no discussion. I'll renew my motion that House File 2915, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Final bill on the agenda for today is House File 1086. Representative Smith. Representative Smith moves that House File 1086 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And there are quite a number of amendments. Representative Smith, do you want to go through some of the amendments first or talk about the bill?
Mr. Chairman, let's, without your objection or the committee's, why don't we just go right to the amendments?
Okay. This is the Omnibus Pension Bill, and I'm going to recognize Representative Rukavina first on an amendment he has, because I know he's got a scheduling issue. Representative Rukavina, I'm not even I'm going through trying to find which one is yours. A6?
A6 amendment.
Okay, Representative Rukavina moves the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, just to be right up front about this, any of you remember Virginia Sandy? Virginia Sandy, who was an employee of ours at the House DFL side for quite a few years. When we had to downsize after the last elections, she was one of the DFL staff folks who got laid off. Virginia then had exercised her right to move her plan from the unclassified program to MSRS, and she was rehired then before ever retiring and receiving retirement benefits. She was hired by the Senate. Unfortunately, we know what happened. She died unexpectedly right after the session started. She would have had the option to go back to the unclassified program, which would have allowed her children, I believe she has two children, Scott, who I know, and his brother, to receive both her contribution and the House's contribution, legislative contribution. Before she could do that, however, she passed away, and what the bill does is basically allow the beneficiaries, the two children, to make that decision. I believe it gives them up to a year to do it, if I'm not mistaken. And I don't think there's any opposition. Dave Bergstrom from the MSRS is here, and said it was a unique circumstance and it would be a reasonable amendment to the pension bill, and I believe in the past over in the Senate, so I'd appreciate your support, members, for this amendment.
Discussion to the Rukavina amendment. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to oppose or support the amendment.
Okay. Other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the Rukavina amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The Rukavina amendment is adopted. All right, members, let me next go to a couple of, I think, technical amendments. The LCPR 04-210 amendment. The chair will move the 210 amendment, and I believe this is just a technical amendment. Mr. Martin, can you confirm that? The 210 amendment?
Yes, members. I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission. There's an incorrect citation to a prior special law in a title, and this corrects that error.
All right. All in favor of the 210 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, next we have the 1432 amendment, which Mr. Marks had, I believe, brought forward as a correction. Oh, excuse me. I thought I had it already. Okay, let's pass it out. Let's pass out the 1432 amendment. Mr. Marks, can you speak to this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, article, this amendment would delete Article 18 in the bill. Article 18 was also in House File 890, which is now Senate File 806, I believe, on the General Register. It deals with the actuarial changes. The issue here is that this Article 18 in and of itself reduces revenue to the general fund by $162,000. The other bill also makes a reduction of $152,000 in the appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for the Pensions Commission, so that the net cost is $10,000, and that was covered in the state government finance bill. Article 18 does not have the corresponding reduction to the LCC appropriation, so there are really two ways to deal with it. One is to delete Article 18 from the bill, or the other one is to add language to Article 18 that reduces the LCC appropriation by $152,000. This amendment would delete Article 18 because it's already in that other bill.
Discussion to the 1432 amendment. Representative Krenke.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what makes us think that the state government finance bill may pass versus the pension bill may pass?
Hey, come on.
Representative Krenke, what makes you think the pension bill is going to pass?
Mr. Chair, the other bill I'm referring to is not the state government finance bill. It's a separate bill carried by Representative Smith, now Senate File 806 on the General Register. The costs are covered as part of the state government finance bill, but the language is in a separate bill.
I think that was the House File 890 that this committee passed out a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
Other discussion to the 1432 amendment. All in favor of the 1432 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Let's see. Representative Smith, why don't I go to you on the 224 amendment dealing with Rush City Correctional Employees. Representative Smith moves the 224 amendment.
Okay.
Representative Smith or Mr. Martin, can you describe the amendment?
Members, I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. This adds three individual occupational positions at the Rush City Correctional facility to the MSRS Correctional Plan. When Rush City was first built, no additions were made to the MSRS Correctional Plan to cover the individuals who are serving at that facility who would normally be covered in all of the other prisons. So this clarifies the three positions that fully qualify for the special coverage.
Discussion to the 224 amendment. Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, why would they have not been added when the facility was built?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krenke, corrections may be here to answer that question. I suspect it's an oversight.
I doubt that it's an intentional matter. The prison, as I understand it, was built and was staffed in waves. It's staffed in over a period of time as they grew. And so some of these positions may not have been there from day one. My suspicion is it's simply an oversight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'm sorry, I was distracted. Did we want someone from the Corrections Department to come down? No. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there's no further questions. No on that.
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. If there's no further questions on that, no, we don't need the testimony.
All right. if there are no further questions, Representative Smith renews his motion on the 224 amendment. All in favor of the 224 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Next, we'll go to the 227 amendment, which I believe is an amendment suggested by Mr. Martin. The chair will move the 227 amendment. Mr. Martin, can you describe the 227 amendment?
Yes, members. This would represent legislative authorization or validation of a long-standing practice in the Pension Commission when special projects are conducted for third parties. By the Pension Commission, the Commission has billed back the costs of that actuarial work and has restored that money to the Commission budget, but there's never been specific statutory language authorizing that, although we're presumably in the last year of the Pension Commission conducting the having the actuarial services contract. There may be some question about whether this practice can still occur, and this validates that 18-year practice.
Discussion of the 227 amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the 227 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Next, members, the chair will move the 221 amendment, and I'm going to have Mr. Martin discuss the 221 amendment. There's also one individual who would like to testify on it. This amendment deals with some language that has been kind of in and out of the bill dealing with school administrators. Mr. Martin, the 221 amendment, could you describe the 221 amendment?
Yes, members. The 221 amendment would pertain to the statewide TRA plan. This relates to school administrators, specifically superintendents, assistant superintendents, and principals. There has been some indication from information supplied by TRA that there may be inappropriate salary amounts that have been filtering into the high fives of the highest five average salaries of our retiring upper-end school administrators, and this would require that TRA do an audit prior to calculating the pension benefit to ensure that the school administrator's salary figures all match the TRA-covered salary definition. And it provides for a report to the legislature about the findings of TRA when they conduct these special salary audits.
And I have a Mr. Kite who had signed up to testify, if he could come forward. Mr. Kite, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Charlie Kite. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And we concur with the purpose of this amendment, but we would suggest a friendly change. I hope it would see this friendly. As you go to line 23 on page 3, and this is where it identifies, it simply says superintendent, assistant superintendent, or principal. We would suggest that language say instead, employee with a salary exceeding 95% of the governor's salary. That way it makes a very clear cut line of who would be audited and who wouldn't be audited. And we know that within our ranks we have people of many different definitions of jobs. And if we leave it as superintendents, assistant superintendents, and principals, it starts to get open to a lot of interpretation. We believe TRA would support this position and would make it more consistent in terms of their auditing. So we just present that as a friendly change.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair and sir, I'm sorry I didn't get your name. But how many, if we would adopt that suggestion, how many people would be eliminated from an audit of the administration of those three categories? In other words, what percentage of employees are above the 95% of the governor, or at the 95% of the governors?
Mr. Kite.
Representative Silver, I'm not sure I have the exact number to that. I believe in terms of TRA members who are at or exceeding that 95% number right now, I believe there are 90-plus people. I don't know how many there would be otherwise if you include the whole group. I would guess probably another 200 to 300.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I would think that the language that's before us is an attempt to make sure that nobody is using the high five in any kind of a way that's inappropriate. And it seems to me that if you were to eliminate to just those that are above the 95%, that you're taking away an audit of an awful lot of people that may be potentially misusing that that high five.
Representative Solberg and members of the committee, a concern that we have is that this language prohibits TRA from beginning the annuities to any member that does not have an audit completed. And one of our concerns is that we're going to have so many audits that TRA has to complete that they're going to have difficulty actually completing them in the time from which people apply for retirement and the time that the annuity should start to be being paid on a monthly basis. So we're trying to get this to a reasonable number and still make sure that we're dealing with the issue of the highly compensated people.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Solberg.
One suggestion then would be to start the annuity with ability to have it when the audit's completed an adjustment on the annuity. And I think that is the case with just about everybody on TRA. You apply and you may generally get a small of an increase when they finally get your final figures in from the school district, but they start the annuity quicker than that. Mm-hmm. I would think that you should be able to adjust both up and down after the audit is completed.
Well, Mr. Kite, I assume that most school administrators in the state are probably members of your association, or at least you have a sense for how many retire in an average year. How many of you remember?
In the last 5 years, there were 202 retiring administrators in the state, so they're retiring at a rate of about 50 people a year.
And do you believe that that would be a problem to compute and take care of?
Chairman Knobloch, I think maybe that's an answer better asked of TRA, but I have some concerns, and I've heard them state that they do have some concerns of getting all that done.
Okay. Representative Segrin.
Mr. Chair, and maybe we ought to just put the issue on the table here instead of beating around the bush. I think this is really coming from a few superintendents who, you know, were publicly in the paper and had some highly paid salaries, and part of it, they had some benefits mixed in with it, and some concerns about did that then go towards their high five, and did they get a cushier annuity than they deserve to have. So I think that Mr. Kite is right. I think that it probably would be better to focus on exactly what we're trying to get at. I don't think that they're are too many assistant superintendents or principals where they're getting a lot of other additional bennies and stuff that are pushing up their high five. Now, I may be wrong on that, and I'll ask Mr. Kite that if he's aware of any other kind of salary packages for assistant superintendents or principals that, you know, would have the same kind of concerns. But and I would also concur with Representative Solberg, too. Either we do all of these, but then we allow them to get their annuity and then have an adjustment once the audit's done, or we do Mr. Kite's suggestion and just focus on these folks that we're, you know, concerned about that may have been scamming the system. I don't think most people have been, but if there are, then we need to have some audits done to confirm that. But we should do one of these. I don't think we need to I think it needs to be softened up a little bit somehow.
I see an individual from TRA here. Perhaps he could come forward and give us his testimony.
Mr. Mr. Chair and members. I'm Gary Austin, Executive Director of Teachers Retirement. TRA would consider this to be a friendly amendment. We feel that TRA does a good job of auditing on an ongoing basis. Certainly, the senator that first brought forth this concern was looking for highly compensated administrators, and we have run this language by him, the 95% provision, and I think he's comfortable with that. The original language simply said administrators in Senate government finance, I think, is where the language was tried to clarify somewhat what was to be called administrators, and as Mr. Kite indicated, sometimes these job classifications get to be a little bit clumsy, and TRA is not totally sure if they're an assistant superintendent or whatever. So TRA would consider this amendment to be a friendly change.
I'm sorry, Mr. Austin, you consider the 221 amendment to be a friendly change or the 95% language to be
Mr.
a friendly
Chairman,
change?
Mr. Chairman, we consider the 95% change to be a favorable change.
All right. Other discussion to the 221 amendment? Representative Smith, any comments you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Segrin.
Well, then I would like to move that we strike on line 23, superintendent, assistant superintendent, our principal, and insert instead employee that exceeds 95% of the governor's salary.
Well, Representative Segrin, I think what I'll do is I think we need to do something here. I'm not sure if the 95% is the right thing, but it looks like there will be some difference with the Senate bill here anyway. Maybe that can be worked out. I'll incorporate that into my 221 amendment.
My oral?
Your oral amendment, okay. Yes. Other discussion to the 221 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the 221 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Mr. Martin can come back up. Next, members, I'll move the 222 amendment. This was an issue that Mr. Martin also brought forward as an issue where he thought there was a problem that needed to be cleaned up. And, Mr. Martin, maybe you could talk about the 222 amendment.
Members, I'm Larry Martin from the Legislative Commission on Pensions. What the Dash 222 amendment does is clarifies the military service credit purchase provisions in the law, in the Omnibus Pension Bill. There some restrictions on prior military service credit purchases are being stricken in the legislation. This would reinstate part of those our requirements. It would limit the purchases to only one period of prior military service in one Minnesota pension plan, not allowing that same period of prior military service to be purchased in multiple Minnesota pension plans.
Discussion of the 222 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith moves the 223 amendment. Representative Smith.
Yeah.
Or Mr. Martin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to let Mr. Martin explain it, but this is an amendment, except for a reference to Gillette Hospital. This is a proposed amendment that the Pension Commission discussed and laid over couple of weeks ago. Following that, by 2 days, the Senate took up the amendment and passed it with a lot of additional language in it. It's action that we need to address, and therefore this amendment with additional language referencing the Gillette Hospital is before us. And based on my take on discussion at the Pension Commission, I think we need to act. I think this is an appropriate amendment, and I'd ask Mr. Martin to more fully explain it.
Mr. Martin.
Yes, members. This relates to the 223 amendment. There is a general provision in law added about a decade ago which sets an upper end limit on what salaries can be covered for public pension plan purposes, and that basically is 95% of the salary of the governor. There were some individuals or some instances that the legislature recognized then that should be exceptions, including the governor, and some have been added since. This would increase the number of exceptions to the 95% rule. The reason for the 95% cap was a concern about those instances where salaries were being set in other than a public forum, other than by a public body. So what is being added as exceptions are instances where salaries are being set that might exceed 95% of the governor's salary or do, where we have trust in the salary-setting process, either because the legislature sets the salary in the case of judges, or because the salary is collectively bargained or otherwise set through a normal bargaining or a normal salary-setting process, which is, if you look at page 1, lines 22 and 23, this would be state employees who largely have collectively bargained salaries. The only other instance would be on page 1, lines 24 to 26, which relates to Gillette Hospital. Gillette Hospital has been privatized 1987, I believe, and some individuals have been grandparented in and still retain coverage by the state retirement system, and those individuals would also be accepted.
Representative Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, I would oppose the amendment and ask for a roll call vote. Members, what we're doing here is we are retroactively going back and saying that people who violated state law are going to now be forgiven. It was up to the plans and up to these people to know what state law was and to understand that they could not make contributions above 95% for salaries above 95% of the governor's salary, and to sit here 10 years later and say, mea culpa, we forgive you, I don't think is good policy. It'd be one thing, members, if we were going to prospectively say that we were going to allow contributions above 95% of the governor's salary, but to retroactively do that, members, I don't think is a responsive, and there should be people held accountable for violation of state law.
Okay, before we get into those numbers, you know, Representative Smith, this, I guess when I picked this one, it was a little bit out of order from what I was going to pick in terms of getting into this discussion, and I'm not sure if we're going to finish this whole bill today, given some of the other items that are before us. I wonder, Representative Smith, if we, if you'd be willing to withdraw that amendment now, and we can get into a more extensive discussion of this one, either perhaps later today after we've dealt with some other testimony that's here, or whenever we take the bill up.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw it if I may have 10 seconds to respond to that.
You absolutely may.
The comment offered by Representative Krenke sounds good, but I think it's without merit, because the individuals involved here were not the violators, if you will, of rule or law. It was the pension fund administrators who neglected to follow precisely the law, and I don't believe we should hold the individuals harmless, and therefore, at this time at least, I will withdraw the amendment.
Okay, we'll get back to it. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Solberg.
Can I just ask a question on the amendment, though, so for my clarifications on line 32 through 36, that retroactivity, would that apply what I would is that the retroactive part that would be affected as opposed
Mr. Chairman,
to the other part?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, some individuals from Minsky, for sure, were above the salary cap and have already chosen to retire. And so there's some difficulty there. We haven't tracked precisely when they started to retire. So this is making it retroactive back to when the general cap was first put in place to make sure that we got them.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Swenson, let's go to your amendment, the 226 amendment. Representative Swenson moves the 226 amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. 226 amendment is dealing with the St. Peter Community Health Care Center. They're in the process of expecting that later this year, if, or next year they'll be privatizing the employees of a new of a community healthcare center, which have been public employees. What this would do, it would make them eligible for the provisions of Chapter 353F, which under which there's also already two facilities in this bill that's before us today at Wadena and Renville. There's also three facilities that I know of that have been given this provision previously at Glencoe, Waconia, and Laverne. This would make the these employees subject to the same provisions as these other facilities that have been granted previously. And if Mr. Martin wants to add any more clarification.
Mr. Martin, would you like some more? Would you like to add some more clarification?
Members, as noted, this does replicate some others in the bill already. It's the same sort of circumstance, and it's only triggered if the actuarial work indicates there's a net actuarial gain to the pension plan. If this were to be a cost item to the pension plan, it would not go into effect.
And Mr. Martin, does this apply only to this applies only to current employees? It does not apply to future employees who might be hired by this institution?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It basically gives them some greater augmentation during the period between when they quit being public employees and when they choose to retire. It also allows them to qualify for the rule of 90 for qualification purposes using future service, but does not credit their future service for the benefit calculation. So it tries to hold them as harmless as we can for the service rendered to date in this facility. Anyone who come on new was not covered, and since they have no public pension pension plan credit, has no application to them anyway. So this is solely trying to keep what their benefits are today as close to being whole, despite the fact that they're being privatized, as we can.
Discussion to the 226 Amendment. Representative Kroenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, will you explain, if you could, for us the inconsistency within the various provisions of this bill as to how we treat these privatization of facilities?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kroenke, yes, we're consistent in that when we're requested to place people in the privatized provisions, we have added the privatized facility to that law. In two instances in the bill where we're requested for the privatized employees to retain PERA pension coverage, we have retained that pension coverage. So we have complied with the desires of the employers and the employees in these various cases. The treatment of the two groups is different. In the case of the St. Peter facility and the other two facilities in the bill, they are being held harmless for their past pension credit that they've earned. The individuals in the Anoka Achieve program and the government training services facility, those individuals would retain pension coverage into the future, but only individuals who are currently covered by PERA.
Representative Kroenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Martin, in order to achieve, we know that the legislature is inconsistent from day to day, week to week, but wouldn't it be beneficial if we tried to treat all of these privatizations in the same manner, either one or the other, not to treat some differently than others?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, uniformity or consistency clearly has its place. The problem, I think, is that for various medical facilities where the employer would be unwilling to continue expending the cost, the employer contribution for PERA coverage, you would have several of these medical centers simply privatizing and having no additional pension coverage, no substantiation or validation of their benefits rendered to date. They would come out in worse shape than what is currently happening. So that those instances where the employer is willing to pay the future PERA contributions, that would occur. And instances like the Renville Nursing Home and Fair Oaks where the employer probably is on a closer margin or there are other financial difficulties, those individuals would probably have diminished pension coverage less than what would be provided to the ANOCA achieve. So if you did it, if you followed the continuation into the future of pension coverage, you're likely to leave some people behind. If you were to provide less pension coverage to the ANOCA achieve individuals and the government training office, those individuals would be harmed despite the fact that their employer desires to keep them in the pension coverage. I think we're meeting a demand that differs and a set of requests that are different, and as a consequence, given the financial circumstances of each employment setting, we may in fact have to treat them differently.
Mr.
Representative Prinky.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, you know, what we're doing here is allowing the employers to dictate to us that people will be continue to be covered under a public pension plan when they're private employers.
Any other discussion? Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Representative Swenson or Mr. Martin, this is just for current employees that are switching over from the public to the private, or is this all new hires too?
Mr. Representative Swenson.
Well, I think Mr. Martin already answered that question a few minutes ago that it would only be current employees. It would not apply to new employees.
Okay, I just missed it. I was having another conversation.
Any other discussion to the 226 amendment? See no further discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, there is one other amendment in your packets dealing with the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. There's another I have up here. I want to have some testimony on that issue, but before we get into that, other than the amendment that Representative Smith withdrew, are there any other amendments that people have?
So we have three before.
That they wish to offer.
We have two.
Yeah, 19 relates to the Police Relief Association. I'm not sure if anyone is off Police Relief Association. I'm not sure if anyone is offering 220. I know it had been prepared. I don't know if anyone is interested in offering that one. I think that it revises some of the police and fire disability coverage in the bill. Okay, with that, members, what I'd like to do is there is an issue with the Minneapolis Police Relief Association that did not start out as a pension commission recommendation. It was added in state government finance. It's section 19, I believe, in the bill. It's gotten a fair amount of discussion, and I'd like to have someone from the police association come down and give their testimony on it and why it should stay. I believe there's also someone from the city of Minneapolis who at least earlier was opposed to the provision being in the bill that wants to come down and testify.
That's section 13.
I believe it's section 19.
Article
19, I'm sorry. Article 19 at the very end of the bill.
Is someone moving an amendment?
I'm not going to move an amendment at this time, no. I think we'll just have discussion about the provision, Article 19, that is in the bill, and why it's in there, and why some feel it should be either removed or changed.
Okay.
Mr. Nelson, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please give us your name for the record and your testimony.
Committee. Dick Nelson, I represent the Minneapolis Retired Police and the Pension Board. I've been lobbying for them since 1967, and then I'm also on the Minnesota Police Pension Council. And I'm handing out this material that we started this discussion and asked to do this with the mayor here some time ago last fall to help him do something about this heavy bonding the city has to do each year. And they bonded last year to pay the pension obligation. And by the way, most of the majority of the funds in this state, their funding date is 2020. Ours is 2010. Representative Gunther, his from Fairmont, is 2010. I think the Bloomington Fire was the other one. But most of them are 2020, and I think the Minneapolis Fire is 2017, if I'm correct. I was going to think it is. Anyhow, so on the discussion on this funding, we went along with thoughts and some ideas in our board and passed some things around, had some brief discussions with the city, and then they started to move along and they just didn't, they kind of fell by the wayside. Well, time was running out with the Pension Commission, and Mr. Representative Smith says, if you get a bill, you better get it in. So we did get the bill in to get it up for discussion. And in the Pension Commission, the bill was voted 7 out of 10 votes. We didn't make the priority on the House side. It was 3 votes we needed. There was 2 there and 5 on the Senate side. The reason for the bill was 7. When I passed out, you'll see that first sheet here, retirement spouse. And I put down, also you've got a sheet on medical costs. When we went along with this problem, most of the retiree plans in this state of Minnesota, I'd say over 90% of them, when a person retires from any of the public pension plans, there is absolutely no support from anybody. You have to pay your own way. An example on the back page, what I pay to my supplement of me and my wife, I pay $516.70 a month. That's a little over $6,000 a year. The unit increase we're talking about is worth about $83. This would cut my expenses down to about $5,000 a year still I would be paying for health insurance. And so we thought, in all fairness in this discussion, that this, and we cut the rate down also on the 13th check valuation, and Brian will explain that to you when he gets here, that this was a negotiating thing. And that's why when the committee, when Representative Kahn changed it and went to the other committee, and then after that committee passed it out tentatively, we talked with Chairman Knobloch, Representative Haas, and Representative Solberg. We had, and they knew what we were doing and why we did it. And so that's why we processed up to this far. And I think it's self-explanatory, the things we're doing in this bill. We are a closed fund. By the way, the positive side of it, you know, this last year, our fund gained 22.7%. We've been meeting these things that the city wanted us to do after that fraud we had a few years ago. We've tightened up things. We made $50 million above payroll in all costs in our little plan. So we're on the track. And I think the cost projections, I'm saying, and as far as the, we've got some other stuff we can hand out, but that's the reason, the necessity of the bill, and we wanted to move on. And I appreciate all your support on this bill. Brian, you want to answer the technical questions?
Mr. Rice, maybe you can just tell us briefly what Article 19 does.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm General Counsel of Minneapolis Police Relief Association. What Article 19 of the bill does primarily is extend the funding date for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. The full funding date that's currently in statute is December 31, 2010, to December 31st, 2020. If the members would like to think of it, it's like refinancing your house and adding 10 more years to the mortgage payment. In addition to extending the funding date, it also grants an additional one-unit benefit to existing retirees and surviving spouses. And I think Representative Haas commented earlier when they were talking about loss reserves that happened as a result of 9/11 and how those reserves were brought down. I think everyone knows the stock market took a significant dip in 2001 and 2002. That resulted in much higher contribution rates that were necessary for the city of Minneapolis. In 2008, the city virtually had no contribution to the fund. Next year, because 2010 is the full funding date, they'll have to come up with approximately $31 million next year and in subsequent years to meet that full funding target. This bill would reduce those requirements of the city from about total employer contributions from about $30 million down to $15 million. I do have some handouts that would explain if the committee would help understand it. Last fall, when the city was looking at this issue, the mayor had a number of pension funds present. He asked the funds to put their thinking hats on and see if there was a solution to it. The police pension fund went back, came up with this idea of extending the full funding date, which would reduce the city's contributions, We also found that by doing that, it would diminish the future payments of the 13th check to police fund members by about $40 million. What we looked at doing that to compensate for that was to add this additional unit, which would provide a benefit of about $12 million to the vast majority of members who are living today. The other provisions in the bill deal with a those are the main features, and I could answer questions if members had it.
Okay, so as I understand it, Mr. Rice, the city, the fund has a significant unfunded liability right now that the city is making fairly large contributions annually to take care of, with the goal of having the fund fully funded by 2010. The language in the bill would say they don't have to make as large of contributions now. They can just make a smaller contribution, but for a longer period of time, out to 2020. So they don't have to make as large of a contribution. I understand they would maybe be issuing pension bonds to deal with some of that contribution. There would be a benefit increase for the members of the fund then, which would be paid for in part by the fact that they don't have to have as much of an increase, or the city doesn't have as large of a contribution each year into the fund. I guess what I don't understand is what, in terms of the 13th check and the changes that take place with that, why are you saying that this saves the state money?
Mr. Chairman, so far you're doing very good. You got an A+.
Yeah, I'm breaking down now.
No, you're getting there. The issue is when you the Minneapolis Police Fund is really that, and Minneapolis Fire are unique in the state. They're really the only two funds I know that the benefits in some manner are tied to the amount of assets that are in the fund. The 13th check works like this. When the fund's under 102% funded, 0.5% of the assets, if they have good investment returns, get divided up by the members. If it's over 102%, it's 1.5% of the assets. And if it's over 110%, it's about 2.5% of the assets. So the members want to see more assets in the fund. The more the assets that are in the fund, the greater the annual 13th check payment is. Now think of it this way. If you could all accelerate 10 years of your legislative salary and get it paid up front now, that would be a nice set of money to have to live off of in future years. What happens if you in with the police pension fund, they're seeing those payments, $100-some million between now and 2010, and those assets will build the fund up to about $450 million very quickly, and then those assets can get divided if they have big payments. But if you extend that payment out, instead of in 6 years, in 16 years, the assets are going to build up more slowly. Because the assets build up more slowly, the future value of the 13th check drops by about $40 million. And I've given these to you, Mr. Chairman. I could give them to the committee, but at this hour, I'm not sure anybody would be particularly interested. Our actuary tells us by extending it out, it costs $40 million in future 13th check payments. As we looked at that, you may say, why would a pension fund come to you and say, cut our benefits by $40 million? The problem is this is a closed fund. There's 960 members. You saw Mr. Nelson. He's got colleagues. We're losing about 30 members a year, and that's what the actuary says. So 15, 20 years from now, when we could have huge 13th check payments that would amount to almost a half year's worth of a pension, it would go to very few members who are alive at the time. Working with the actuary, we restructured it so we could get a little bit now for everyone for a long time, which is about a $12 million benefit, and in the directors' members, who are our fiduciaries, in their judgment, it was a worthwhile trade-off, and at the same time, we could help the city out of what's a significant increase in pensions. And I might add, it's got a local approval clause, so if everything we're saying doesn't make sense to the city, let the city council say no, and we'll come back next year.
Okay, it is Mr. Rice, I understand that as far as the state's perspective goes, we are contributing $1.7 million a year, roughly, toward the toward making the fund whole.
Correct.
And if the stock market, is it true if the stock market doesn't perform, if there aren't excess investment earnings, we would then be, underneath current law, be contributing an additional $1.7 million a year, roughly, for the additional 10 years if we did this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think you got it partially correct. When the state helps fund this plan, and But when the fund does well, when it has good investment performance, we tell the state, don't send us your money. That money flows to Minneapolis teachers, St. Paul teachers, or volunteer pension funds. But in years when we don't do so well, like happened in 2000, 2001, and 2002, we get the money coming to us rather than to them. By extending the funding date from 2010 to 2020, you continue the arrangement where in years when we have bad investment performance, that $1.7 million would come to the police pension fund. You're not going to create any new appropriations by this. That money's already appropriated under statute. It's appropriated until the point in time that the Minneapolis Teachers Fund is fully funded, which I think, as you know, Mr. Chairman, since you've worked on the issue, is quite a ways away. So it does do that. This bill would extend that 10-year period where the state, in essence, I wouldn't say it's almost like a line of credit, and that line of credit only gets called on in bad financial years. Our experience has been that about 8 out of 10 years, we earn our 13th check. 8 out of 10 years, we don't get any money from the state, or 2 out of 10 years, we do. I think a realistic way to look at it is if you pass this bill, from what we know sitting here today, there would be 2 years in the decade of 2011 to 2020 where this fund would get some state aid that it otherwise wouldn't.
You know, members, I know it's getting late, but we've got a couple of witnesses we have to hear from on this important issue still. But Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, or Mr. Rice, on your illustration here, you show the liability to the city of Minneapolis for 2004 to 2005. Do you have projections of what it's going to be in the out years? Because we may be saving money today, but what is their future liability?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Haas, yes, we've got 30-year projections. I could share that with you now after the committee. And what we did, Mr. Chairman, we've had some discussions. Originally, we came and said we use a 9.1% rate of asset returns, which is what our actuary said, given our current asset mix, looking back to 1927 is what we'd have. The city thought that was too aggressive. We looked at a 7% return, which some thought was too conservative. So we used 8.5%, which is what I gave you, Representative Haas, which is what the state assumption is. And actually, the worse the fund performs, the more the city, I would submit, needs this. Because in any pension fund, 70% of all the money you'll take out is not what you contributed or your employer contributed. It's what the money in the fund made. 70%. But everybody here has a pension plan of some kind. 457 deferred comp. 70% of what you're going to take out is not coming from what you put in or the employer put in. It's investment earnings. And so that's really the key on this. And by extending that date, the 8.5% Representative Haas, when you look at it, would show you what the first sheet is, what the current plan is, which shows the employer contributions will have to be about $107 million in the next 6 years. And by the way, on a net present value, because you're extending the time horizon on which the fund potentially can earn assets, that's why we submit that this works. You know, it's similar to some other financing issues you've had to look at. Again, it's optional to the city. If they don't, after studying it carefully, they conclude it doesn't make sense and they don't approve it, it doesn't get approved, and we'll have to come back with maybe another idea. We would submit to the legislature it's a laboratory, it's an experiment that's worth trying. I don't see that there's a huge extension of the state's commitment, ultimately the city has to pay for it, and if they deem it's not advisable, then they shouldn't enact the provisions.
Representative Guinness.
Yes, thank you. Since you have this clause that says the city can or cannot do this, I'm not understanding why you didn't go to the city first and say, can we come with this joint proposal or not? Why that wasn't put out with the city before you come here? I don't understand that.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bouguinis, we did approach the city. The fund's directors began some discussions with the city well over a year ago. It was not a particularly receptive response. They renewed the discussions again last year. I think the city, this is a complicated issue. There was not much progress with the city on this issue, Representative Bouguinis. The fund's directors, who have a fiduciary obligation to the members, the city, and the state taxpayers under state law, made a determination that we should approach the legislature. We talked to Representative Kahn, who got quite excited about the bill. She's been a longtime opponent of the city bonding for any pension debt. She encouraged us to go forward. We encouraged her to consider taking it. And I actually think that's probably led to some positive discussions with the city that we wouldn't have had but for legislative intervention, quite honestly. I think if we'd not brought this issue forward, it would sit there and not get any attention. I know, Mr. Chairman, you've worked on the Minneapolis teachers issue for a long time. If at some point the legislature doesn't show up and try to do something, nothing happens. These things just sit because there's, you know, it's hard to get people to deal with things. I'll tell you from my experience, we had an issue like this almost 16 years ago with the city. Same thing. We started out, eventually we did come up with a plan. It took us 2 years. I think it worked out well for the city and it worked out well for the members. These are difficult issues. They're very complex.
Representative Wagenius, I'm wondering, how about if we have someone here from the city of Minneapolis who wants to testify? How about if we have them come down? Would Ms. Heather Johnston come forward?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Nelson.
I just want to add one thing to the committee. Remember, it's a unique situation. I've got over 500.
Well, could you speak into the microphone, Mr. Sorry. Nelson?
It's a unique situation. I've got over 500 and some people over 65 years of age. The majority of my people are over 70 years of age. That's the majority. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heather Johnston, the Director of Management and Budget for the City of Minneapolis. I'll try and keep my comments very brief here, knowing that the hour is getting late. As some of my testimony actually has been covered by Mr. Rice in terms of mentioning that the city has three closed-end pension funds for which we are responsible for paying over $350 million by 2020. As you all know, this represents a significant pressure on our property taxes. The mayor and council have directed us to work with the pension funds to reduce our, to manage our financial commitments that we have in the next few years. As a part of this, the city council adopted a position on pension legislation in April that talked about reducing the city's funding obligations, supporting improved investment administrative management practice. Containing any legislation should also contain a local approval clause and then maintain existing financing and funding options. The article of the bill in its entirety does, in with the benefit increase the city's financial obligations. If the investments do provide, we certainly do support the piece of the bill that extends the date to 2020, because that does help the city. It allows our financial investments time to recover and reduces our financial obligation overall. Obviously, that's a big if, considering how investments have been doing nowadays. So that is our concern, but we wanted to continue to look at the issue with all three of the pension funds for which we have significant financial obligations over the summer and come back with a legislative proposal next time around and continue our conversations that we've been having with MPRA as well.
Well, Ms. Johnston, then, are you saying that you are opposed to Article 19 being in the bill at this time? Is that the city's position?
Mr. Chair, that is the city's position.
All right. Representative Silberg.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any oar in this water at all, except that I want to ask a question. If the city is having difficulties managing and has to go out for a $31 million bond, and this at least reduces that by $16 million to $15 million, why would the city not at least, and also it has a local approval, doesn't this give the city some additional options? I mean, if they don't want it, they don't have to take it.
Ms. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, certainly we support the local approval clause, and we'll take it to the City Council will look at the issue. It's our understanding, based on the criteria that they've set forth, that it's not a bill in its entirety that it would that the Council would support. That's my current understanding. However, as you indicate, that first piece, extending it to 2020, does help the city. What we need to keep in mind is that we have these other two funds for which the city has financial responsibility. And so some of the other provisions included in the article may have impacts on our other funds, or at least potentially in terms of future legislation, and so we're concerned about that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Silver.
One additional follow-up, and that is to somebody. If we do the other funds are out at 2020, is that correct?
I believe so, Representative
Silver. And so this change would not necessarily make an additional obligation for the state beyond the 2010, then, because we'd have that obligation to the other funds. Is that correct?
Well, Representative Solberg, I guess my understanding is that the $1.7 million a year, whatever that we're paying here, if we did not pay it into this fund, would go into some other fund to shore up Minneapolis teachers or some other fund.
Those are asked from 2010 to 2020, that time period, right?
Well, I guess I don't know. I believe so. Beyond that, I don't know.
Okay.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and members, since this issue has come to my attention, we have been meeting both parties for, I think we've had two meetings, and they have been productive in the sense that we've been able to get the parties talking again, because that is one of the issues here, that the parties had sort of stalled out in terms of their conversations around this issue. And the city has come back with a proposal that I believe the city council is going to formalize around a timeline to discuss the issues, and I hope that'll be happening soon. The other part of this is that this is one of those issues where you have friends on both sides of the issue, and it becomes difficult because the provision is in the bill right now. It certainly is a provision that has gotten the city's attention and is highlighting the need to discuss this further. I have concern about a couple of the provisions in the bill, and if we continue on tonight, I do want to make one motion at least. But generally speaking, I do think that it is getting the discussion moving in the right direction to come back with a solution. As long as local approval is there, the City Council certainly, in terms of the wholeness of this amendment, and it's not a menu approach, they have to either take the whole thing or reject the whole thing. It does continue the discussion, and it is beneficial in that regard. So although I think there was miscommunication last fall about who was moving first and who was going to bring a bill over here, I think that it is one of those things that definitely has highlighted the need for the discussion, and we have used that opportunity to sit down and get the city and the pension fund talking and outlining a plan for how we come forward, which is actually what I'd like to have happen on the Minneapolis teachers issue as well.
I have Representatives Krenke, Haas, and Smith. Representative Krenke.
Mr. Chairman, to the point made earlier by Representative Solberg that he doesn't have an oar in this particular water, members, I think that is incorrect for any legislator to say that, because, number one, I think we all have a fiduciary obligation to any public pensioner in the state of Minnesota. But secondly, members, I think as was stated earlier by Mr. Rice, that the more money that flows to Minneapolis, whether it's Minneapolis police, Minneapolis fire, or Minneapolis teachers, means there's less money going to your local fire relief association.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Johnson, first of all, you have several other funds you have obligations to. Can we get that information by the time we meet, maybe tomorrow, or what your other obligations are, so we can look at the total picture of how that's going to affect the city of Minneapolis? Because we're just looking at one little portion of it and trying to make a decision on one portion of it. And I think, Mr. Chair, we need to look at the total picture to understand what their pension obligation is. And then the other thing is, what is the typical interest rate, Ms. Johnson, on the bonds that you sell for these pensions?
Ms. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I don't have the interest rate, the most recent interest rate with me, because some of the revenue bonds, they have variable interest rates, and so I'd have to check on that. To your first question, of the three closed pension funds, which I mentioned we had $350 million in obligations, the first piece is MRF, and that's approximately $148 million, and then, of course, there's the police relief, which is about $152 million of that $350. Fire relief is about $50 million of that between now and 2020. And we also do make payments to the teachers' funds, but those aren't statutorily required at this point.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted clarification from Ms. Johnson relative to whether Minneapolis supports this portion of the pensions bill. I'm looking at a document, just a photocopy of the city council's action taken April 2, wherein the city of Minneapolis decided to support legislation that meets one or more of the following principles. And one of the principles are whether it contains a local approval clause that gives the city council the right to approve any legislation relating to the closed pension plans. On April 2 of this year, which is a month ago, the city council voted to go forward and amend that report. This legislation contains an approval clause, yet that contradicts the very testimony I just heard. So if I could get some clarification on that.
Ms. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I apologize if I read a little quickly. You do have the same resolution as I read through very quickly in terms of that's one of the four components that the City Council had in their resolution, the first being the reducing the city's funding obligations, and we're concerned that that doesn't meet that piece of the resolution, that this legislation doesn't meet that piece. But that would be the piece that we're talking about.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm just pointing out I'm looking at an actual recorded page of the City Council's resolution where it says if this pension legislation meets one or more of these qualifications that the city supports this bill. That was all.
Okay. I guess I wanted someone from the city to be here is I had had previously someone from the city visit me in my office and also told me that they had opposed it. And it's obviously an issue that has some controversy. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've identified it correctly when you said this is an issue with some controversy. And I think one of the parts is that the take-it-or-leave-it provision is for the whole package, and that some of the things work for the city and some do not, is my understanding. But I would just, one of the things that just I have to remember say is that when we've been talking about how complicated this issue is, there's some implication there that some of my city council members may not understand what's going on. And I feel bad that is an implication on the table. My current city council member is Scott Benson, probably the brightest person I have ever met, and I would like to have him come and testify. City council member I had before, it was Barrett Lane, understands finances better than anybody I know. So I just don't want that kind of notion to be sitting here that we have council members that cannot fully grasp a pension issue. We have city council members that are brighter than a new crop of city council members, and some of them are brighter than any people I know. I just needed to say that.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke corrected me, and I'm wrong again. But I guess not only do I have one ordinance, I got two. And I'm paddling away.
Representative Keller.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the point here is that by having the language before you, it provides a place to build a package. And, yes, this particular language, and this is standard, is that it's all or nothing, and the city council would need to make a decision. And I fully trust my city council to make a decision if it should move forward. However, I do think it also provides the opportunity in terms of negotiation with the city in looking at all three funds to be able to say, these pieces work, this does not, on further analysis, and it does spur the conversation going forward. And so although I am quite aware that the city is concerned about the language in the bill, it, however, does provide a real frankly, a real discussion point, which does not necessarily exist without something there. And so, yes, it is all or nothing. It does have local option in it. It also provides the impetus to keep going forward and have the discussion that probably will lead to a solution that will need to come back to the legislature. And lots of these things take a long time. And by the way, Mr. Chair and members, I do want to say that we are lucky to have Ms. Johnston. As you may recognize, we got to steal her from the Department of Finance, and we are lucky to have her on our team.
Representative Seifert.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just happened to run into the minutes of the Intergovernment Relations Council for Minneapolis here. And happened to see the principles here, and that fourth item was added. They had the ones you talked about, reducing the city's funding obligations, and they added D, maintaining existing financing and funding options. Direction to staff is to work with the Minneapolis Police Relief Association, their attorney Brian Rice, with regard to their current bill, see if there are any acceptable alternatives to the present bill. And I guess what Representative Kelleher said is they'd like to build a package, but I guess that's maybe what I'm afraid of, is that there's going to be a package built in the dark of night on May 15th with the Senate, and we're going to have a take-it-or-leave-it omnibus pension bill, and that we're going to have a very expensive package coming back that a lot of members will feel obligated to vote for because of other provisions in the bill. Mr. Chair, I guess my question is to Representative Smith on who the chief author of this bill in the Senate might be.
Representative Smith.
Senator Betzold to that question.
Senator Betzold is the author of this bill.
Of
the pension bill.
Representative Smith, is Senator Betzold the author of the entire pension bill as well as this particular provision?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, this particular provision, I don't have the answer. I don't know.
But he's the author of the whole pension bill. That was your question, Representative Seifert?
Yeah, well, I was thinking that Senator Pogemiller might be the author of the pension bill.
I just was informed by someone who previously testified, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, that Representative Kahn is the House author of this provision of the bill, and there is no companion Senate file.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Seifert.
I was in state government finance, Representative Kahn brought this forward, but I guess my question was, who is the author of the omnibus pension bill in the Senate?
Betzold.
Senator Betzold.
Senator Betzold.
Senator Betzold. Okay, so they will work this out, but I guess my question is, if this language is in and things go forward as they are, apparently the Senate wants to leave on Thursday or Friday, so maybe we don't need a pension bill because we wouldn't have time to pass one out of the House by then. But my suspicions would be that we tread very carefully on building these issues together because we already have close to $1 billion of unfunded liabilities in various pension funds, and if we don't work towards solutions, we need to be careful about that. So it's just, you know, I'm not saying this is a horrible issue or a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just saying we need to be very careful about this because it seems every time the pension bill goes to conference committee, there's various characters involved on the Senate side that seem to build these things up and then end up adding to the problem rather than to the solution.
Mr. Martin, I'm wondering if you would come down to discuss this, and Representative Kelleher, go ahead while he's coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Seifert, the building the package piece is the piece that happens between now and next legislative session. And that is the process that the city has outlined in my conversations with both folks in terms of bringing the funds together and look at that for further legislative approval. So I don't want you to poison the well here today in terms of, you know, maybe I guess I'll just read into it, Senator Pogemiller is going to pull something over on us here. I think the issue that I was trying to bring forward is that trying to get the parties back together so that they could come up with some ideas as well as look at the full scope of the issue, which is the three pension funds, not just the one pension fund.
And members, I know it's going long here, but Mr. Martin, since you're our advisor in this area, can you give us your brief overview of Article 19 in the bill and sort of the pros and cons as you see them.
Members, very quickly, I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission staff. The Article 19 contains both a change in the funding requirements of the City of Minneapolis and two benefit improvements for the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund, an increase in the unit value, which is their regular service pension, and then a change that would likely make an earlier payment of the 13th check possible. Those are the two benefit improvements. I've raised a number of issues for the Pension Commission when they looked at the bill. I think some of the principal two or three that I would raise here would be tying funding changes together with benefit changes. It's in my experience and in my sense of what's good and bad pension policy that it would be better to do benefit issues on their own as they stand and to do funding issues on their own as they stand, that marrying the two together will lead you to problems, that one tends to drive the other. In this instance, it's fairly clear that the City of Minneapolis would like the funding flexibility and the retirees, principally the Minneapolis Police Pension Fund, would like the benefit improvement, and tying the two together, the Police Pension Fund has reservations about the relaxed funding obligation, but could be placated with a benefit improvement. The City of Minneapolis, I would like the funding flexibility, but may not be interested in providing the benefit improvement. Mixing the two is not required. They can stand policy evaluation on their own, and that would be the optimal way to do things.
Well, members, as we've seen, this is a controversial issue. I appreciate your patience. I think that what we should do at this point is lay the bill over, and we'll take it up at our next meeting, which will be Thursday. Members, I will. It's possible we may have some sort of informational hearing of some kind on the stadium bill tomorrow. Watch your emails. I'll let you know. Right now, our next official scheduled meeting is Thursday, I believe, after session or at 2 o'clock. Watch your agenda on that, but I'll lay this bill over for now. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, we also have in our packet 220. Okay. Is that one that we should keep?
I think that's one you can get rid of unless someone wants to offer it. I will tell you, members, if you can put all this back in your folder so that Ms. Kodrick doesn't have to reassemble it all and you can keep it, just the pension bill, that would be great. Thank you, Shirley, again, for the cookies. Members, thank you very much. Meeting adjourned. Yeah.